which Mr. Fairfield Porter had welcomed him. Had to be tough on you, losing your dad so young. He thought Jack had given him the explanation for the aura of apartness and isolation that seemed always to envelop him. A second before Jack could respond, Dale told himself he was bullshitting. He had no idea how someone wound up being like Jack Sawyer. Yeah, Jack said. Fortunately, my mother was even tougher. Dale seized his opportunity with both hands. What did your folks do? Were you brought up in California? Born and raised in Los Angeles, Jack said. My parents were in the entertainment industry, but don't hold that against them. They were great people. Jack did not invite him to stay for supper. That was what stuck with Dale. Over the hour and a half it took them to hang the rest of the pictures, Jack Sawyer remained friendly and good-humored. But Dale, who was not a cop for nothing, sensed something evasive and adamant in his friend's affability. A door had opened a tiny crack, then slammed shut. The phrase, great people, had placed Jack's parents out of bounds. When the two men broke for another beer, Dale noticed a pair of bags from a Centralia grocery next to the microwave. It was then nearly 8 o'clock, at least 2 hours past French County supper time. Jack might reasonably have assumed that Dale had already eaten, were his uniform not evidence to the contrary. He tossed Jack a softball about the hardest case he had ever solved and sidled up to the counter. The marbled red tips of 2 sirloin steaks protruded from the nearest bag. His stomach emitted a reverberant clamor. Jack ignored the thunder roll and said, Thornburg Kinderling was right up there with anything I handled in L.A. I was really grateful for your help. Dale got the picture. Here was another locked door. This one had declined to open by as much as a crack. History was not spoken here. The past had been nailed shut. They finished their beers and installed the last of the pictures. Over the next few hours, they spoke of 100 things, but always within the boundaries Jack Sawyer had established. Dale was sure that his question about Jack's parents had shortened the evening, but why should that be true? What was the guy hiding? And from whom was he hiding it? After their work was done, Jack thanked him warmly and walked him outside to his car, thereby cutting off any hope of a last-minute reprieve. Case closed, game over, zip up your fly, in the words of the immortal George Rathbun. While they stood in the fragrant darkness beneath the millions of stars arrayed above them, Jack sighed with pleasure and said, I hope you know how grateful I am. Honestly, I'm sorry I have to go back to L.A. Would you look at how beautiful this is? Driving back to French Landing, his the only headlights on the long stretch of Highway 93, Dale wondered if Jack's parents had been involved in some aspect of the entertainment business embarrassing to their adult son, like pornography. Maybe Dad directed skin flicks and Mom starred in them. The people who made dirty movies probably raked in the dough, especially if they kept it in the family. Before his odometer ticked off another 1/10 of a mile, the memory of the little Fairfield Porter turned Dale's satisfaction to dust. No woman who earned her keep having on-camera sex with strangers would spend actual money on a painting like that. Let us enter Jack Sawyer's kitchen. The morning's Herald lies unfolded on the dining table. A black frying pan recently sprayed with Pam heats atop the circle of blue flames from the gas stove's lower front left-hand burner. A tall, fit, distracted-looking man wearing an old USC sweatshirt, jeans, and Italian loafers the color of molasses is swirling a whisk around the interior of a stainless steel bowl containing a large number of raw eggs. Looking at him as he frowns at a vacant section of air well above the shiny bowl, we observe that the beautiful 12-year-old boy last seen in a 4th-floor room of a deserted New Hampshire hotel has aged into a man whose good looks contribute only the smallest portion to what makes him interesting. For that Jack Sawyer is interesting declares itself instantly. Even when troubled to distraction by some private concern, some enigma, we might as well say, in the face of that contemplative frown, Jack Sawyer cannot help but radiate a persuasive authority. Just by looking at him, you know that he is one of those persons to whom others turn when they feel stumped, threatened, or thwarted by circumstance. Intelligence, resolve, and dependability have shaped the cast of his features so deeply that their attractiveness is irrelevant to their meaning. This man never pauses to admire himself in mirrors. Vanity plays no part in his character. It makes perfect sense that he should have been a rising star in the Los Angeles Police Department, that his file bulged with commendations, and that he had been selected for several FBI-sponsored programs and training courses designed to aid the progress of rising stars. A number of Jack's colleagues and superiors had privately concluded that he would become the police commissioner of a city like San Diego or Seattle around the time he turned 40, and 10 to 15 years later, if all went well, step up to San Francisco or New York. More strikingly, Jack's age seems no more relevant than his attractiveness. He has the air of having passed through lifetimes before this one, of having gone places and seen things beyond the scope of most other people. No wonder Dale Gilbertson admires him. No wonder Dale yearns for Jack's assistance. In his place, we would want it too. But our luck would be no better than his. This man has retired. He is out of the game. Sorry, damn shame and all that, but a man's gotta whisk eggs when he's gotta have omelets, as John Wayne said to Dean Martin in Rio Bravo. And as my mama told me, Jack says out loud to himself, she said, "Sonny boy," said she, "when the Duke spoke up, every dang buddy listened up. Lessen he was a-grindin' one of his numerous political axes." Yes, she did. Them were her same exact words, just as she said them to me. A half-second later, he adds, "On that fine morning in Beverly Hills," and finally takes in what he is doing. What we have here is a spectacularly lonely man. Loneliness has been Jack Sawyer's familiar for so long that he takes it for granted. But what you can't fix eventually turns into wallpaper, all right? Plenty of things such as cerebral palsy and Lou Gehrig's disease, to name but two, are worse than loneliness. Loneliness is just part of the program, that's all. Even Dale noticed this aspect of his friend's character, and despite his many virtues, our chief of police cannot be described as a particularly psychological human being. Jack glances at the clock above the stove, and sees he has another 45 minutes before he must drive to French Landing and pick up Henry Layden at the end of his shift. That's good. He has plenty of time. He's keeping it together, the subtext to which is, "Everything is all right and nothing's wrong with me, thank you very much." When Jack woke up this morning, a small voice in his head announced, "I am a coppiceman." Like hell I am, he thought, and told the voice to leave him alone. The little voice could go to hell. He had given up on the coppiceman business. He had walked away from the homicide trade. The lights of a carousel reflected in the bald head of a black man lying dead on the Santa Monica Pier. No! Don't go there. Just don't. That's all. Jack should not have been in Santa Monica anyhow. Santa Monica had its own coppicemen. As far as he knew, they were a swell bunch of guys, though perhaps not quite up to the standard set by that ace boy, whiz-bang, and youngest ever lieutenant of LAPD's homicide division himself. The only reason the ace boy and whiz-bang had been on their turf in the first place was that he had just broken up with this extremely nice, or at least moderately nice, resident of Malibu, Ms. Brooke Greer, a screenwriter greatly esteemed within her genre, the action-adventure romantic comedy, also a person of remarkable wit, insight, and bodily charm. And as he sped homeward down the handsome stretch of the Pacific Coast Highway below the Malibu Canyon exit, he yielded to an uncharacteristically edgy spell of gloom. A few seconds after swinging up the California incline into Santa Monica, he saw the bright ring of the Ferris wheel revolving above the strings of lights and the lively crowd on the pier. A tawdry enchantment, or an enchanted tawdriness, spoke to him from the heart of this scene. On a whim, Jack parked his car and walked down to the array of brilliant lights glowing in the darkness. The last time he had visited the Santa Monica Pier, he had been an excited 6-year-old boy pulling on Lily Cavanaugh Sawyer's hand like a dog straining at a leash. What happened was accidental. It was too meaningless to be called coincidence. Coincidence brings together two previously unrelated elements of a larger story. Here, nothing connected, and there was no larger story. He came to the pier's gaudy entrance and noticed that, after all, the Ferris wheel was not revolving. A circle of stationary lights hung over empty gondolas. For a moment, the giant machine looked like an alien invader, cleverly disguised and biding its time until it could do the maximum amount of damage. Jack could almost hear it purring to itself. Right, he thought. An evil Ferris wheel. Get a grip. You're shaking up more than you want to admit. Then he looked back down at the scene before him and finally took in that his fantasy of the pier had hidden a real-life evil rendered far too familiar by his profession. He had stumbled on to the initial stages of a homicide investigation. Some of the brilliant lights he had seen flashed not from the Ferris wheel, but from the tops of Santa Monica patrol cars. Out on the pier, four uniforms were discouraging a crowd of civilians from breaching the circle of crime scene tape around a brightly illuminated carousel. Jack told himself to leave it alone. He had no role here. Besides that, the carousel aroused some smoky, indistinct feeling, an entire set of unwelcome feelings in him. The carousel was creepier than the stalled Ferris wheel. Carousels had always spooked him, hadn't they? Painted midget horses, frozen into place with their teeth bared and steel poles rammed through their guts. Sadistic kitsch. Walk away, Jack told himself. Your girlfriend dumped you and you're in a rotten mood. And as for carousels... The abrupt descent of a mental lead curtain ended the debate about carousels. Feeling as though pushed from within, Jack stepped onto the pier and began moving through the crowd. He was half-conscious of taking the most unprofessional action of his career. When he had pushed his way to the front of the crowd, he ducked under the tape and flashed his badge at a baby-faced cop who tried to order him back. Somewhere nearby, a guitarist began playing a blues melody Jack could almost identify. The title swam to the surface of his mind, then dove out of sight. The infant cop gave him a puzzled look and walked away to consult one of the detectives standing over a long shape Jack did not quite feel like looking at just then. The music annoyed him. It annoyed him a lot. In fact, it bugged the hell out of him. His irritation was out of proportion to its cause, but what kind of idiot thought homicides needed a soundtrack? A painted horse reared, frozen in the garish light. Jack's stomach tightened, and deep in his chest something fierce and insistent, something at all costs not to be named, flexed itself and threw out its arms, or extended its wings. The terrible something wished to break free and make itself known. Briefly, Jack feared he would have to throw up. The passing of this sensation bought him a moment of uncomfortable clarity. Voluntarily, idly, he had walked into craziness, and now he was crazy. You could put it no other way. Marching toward him with an expression nicely combining disbelief and fury was a detective named Angelo Leone, before his expedient transfer to Santa Monica, a colleague of Jack's, distinguished by his gross appetites, his capacity for violence and corruption, his contempt for all civilians regardless of color, race, creed, or social status, and, to be fair, his fearlessness and utter loyalty to all police officers who went with the program and did the same things he did, which meant anything they could get away with. Angelo Leone's disdain for Jack Sawyer, who had not gone with the program, had equaled his resentment at the younger man's success. In a few seconds, this brutal caveman would be in his face. Instead of trying to figure out how to explain himself to the caveman, he was obsessing about carousels and guitars, attending to the details of going crazy. He had no way of explaining himself. Explanation was impossible. The internal necessity that had pushed him into this position hummed on, But Jack could hardly speak to Angelo Leone of internal necessities, nor could he offer a rational explanation to his captain if Leone filed a complaint. "Well, you see, it was like someone else was pulling my strings, like another person was doing the driving." The first words out of Angelo Leone's fleshy mouth rescued him from disaster. "Don't tell me you're here for a reason, you ambitious little prick." A piratical career like Leone's inevitably exposed the pirate to the danger of an official investigation. A strategic sidestep to a neighboring force offered little protection from the covert archaeological digs police officials mounted into records and reputations when the press gave them no other choice. Every decade or two, do-gooders, whistleblowers, whiners, snitches pissed off civilians, and cops too stupid to accept the time-honored program got together, rammed a cherry bomb up the press's collective anus, and set off an orgy of bloodletting. Leone's essential guilt-inspired paranoia had instantly suggested to him that L.A.'s homicide ace boy might be gilding his resume. As Jack had known it would, his claim of having been pulled toward the scene like a fire horse to a fire magnified Leone's suspicions. "Okay, you happened to walk into my investigation. Fine, now listen to me. If I happen to hear your name in some connection I don't like any time during the next 6 months, make that ever, you'll be pissing through a tube for the rest of your life. Now get the fuck out of here and let me do my job." "I'm gone, Angelo." Leone's partner started to come forward across the gleaming pier. Leone grimaced and waved him back. Without intending to do so, without thinking about it, Jack let his eyes drift past the detective and down to the corpse in front of the carousel. Far more powerfully than it had the first time, the ferocious creature at the center of his chest flexed itself, unfurled, and extended its wings, its arms, its talons, whatever they were, and by means of a tremendous upward surge, attempted to rip free of its moorings. The wings, the arms, the talons crushed Jack's lungs. Hideous claws splayed through his stomach. There is one act a homicide detective, especially a homicide lieutenant, must never commit. And it is this. Confronted with a dead body, he must not puke. Jack struggled to remain on the respectable side of the forbidden. Bile seared the back of his throat, and he closed his eyes. A constellation of glowing dots wavered across his eyelids, the creature, molten and foul, battered against its restraints. Lights reflected in the scalp of a bald black man lying dead beside a carousel. "Not you. No, not you. Knock all you like, but you can't come in." The wings, arms, talons retracted. The creature dwindled to a dozing speck. Having succeeded in avoiding the forbidden act, Jack found himself capable of opening his eyes. He had no idea how much time had passed. Angelo Leone's corrugated forehead, murky eyes, and carnivorous mouth heaved into view and, from a distance of 6 inches, occupied all the available space. "What are we doing here, reviewing our situation? I wish that idiot would put his guitar back in its case." And that was one of the oddest turns of the evening. "Guitar? I don't hear no guitar." Neither, Jack realized, did he. Wouldn't any rational person attempt to put such an episode out of mind, to throw this garbage overboard? You couldn't do anything with it, you couldn't use it, so why hold on to it? The incident on the pier meant nothing. It connected to nothing beyond itself, and it led to nothing. It was literally inconsequential, for it had had no consequences. After his lover had sandbagged him, Jack had lost his bearings, suffered a momentary aberration, and trespassed upon another jurisdiction's crime scene. It was no more than an embarrassing mistake. 56 days and 11 hours later, the ace boy slipped into his captain's office, laid down his shield and his gun, and announced, much to the captain's astonishment, his immediate retirement. Knowing nothing of the confrontation with Detective Leone on the Santa Monica Pier, The captain did not inquire as to the possible influence upon his lieutenant's decision of a stalled carousel and a dead black man. If he had, Jack would have told him he was being ridiculous. "Don't go there," he advises himself, and does an excellent job of not going there. He receives a few involuntary flashes, no more, strobe-lit snapshots of a wooden pony's rearing head, of Angelo Leone's distempered mug, also of one other thing, the object occupying the dead center of the scene in every sense, that which above all must not be witnessed. The instant these imagistic lightning bolts appear, he sends them away. It feels like a magical performance. He is doing magic, good magic. He knows perfectly well that these feats of image banishment represent a form of self-protection, and if the motives behind his need for this protective magic remain unclear, the need is motive enough. "When you gotta have an omelet, you gotta whisk eggs," to quote that unimpeachable authority, Duke Wayne. Jack Sawyer has more on his mind than the irrelevancy suggested by a dream voices having uttered the word policeman in baby talk. These matters, too, he wishes he could send away by the execution of a magic trick. But the wretched matters refuse banishment. They zoom about him like a tribe of wasps. All in all, he is not doing so well, our Jack. He is marking time and staring at the eggs, which no longer look quite right, though he could not say why. The eggs resist interpretation. The eggs are the least of it. In the periphery of his vision, the banner across the front page of the La Riviere Herald seems to rise off the sheet of newsprint and float toward him. Fishermen still at large and nope. That's enough. He turns away with the terrible knowledge of having brought on this fisherman business by himself. How about in Staten Island or in Brooklyn, where the real Albert Fish, a tormented piece of work if there ever was one, found two of his victims? This stuff is making him sick. Two dead kids, the Freneau girl missing and probably dead, body parts eaten, a lunatic who plagiarized from Albert Fish. Dale insisted on assaulting him with information. The details enter his system like a contaminant. The more he learns, and for a man who truly wished to be out of the loop, Jack has learned an amazing amount, the more the poisons swim through his bloodstream, distorting his perceptions. He had come to Norway Valley in flight from a world that had abruptly turned unreliable and rubbery, as if liquefying under thermal pressure. During his last month in Los Angeles, the thermal pressure had become intolerable. Grotesque possibilities leered from darkened windows and the gaps between buildings, threatening to take form. On days off, the sensation of dishwater greasing his lungs made him gasp for breath and fight against nausea, so he worked without stopping, in the process solving more cases than ever before. His diagnosis was that the work was getting to him, but we can hardly blame the captain for his astonishment at the ace boy's resignation. He had escaped to this obscure pocket of the countryside, this shelter, this haven at the edge of a yellow meadow, removed from the world of threat and madness, removed by nearly 20 miles from French Landing, removed a good distance even from Norway Valley Road. However, the layers of removal had failed to do their job. What he was trying to escape riots around him again here in his redoubt. If he let himself succumb to self-centered fantasy, he would have to conclude that what he had fled had spent the last 3 years sniffing his trail and had finally succeeded in tracking him down. In California, the rigors of his task had overwhelmed him. Now the disorders of western Wisconsin must be kept at arm's length. Sometimes, late at night, he awakens to the echo of the little, poisoned voice wailing, "No more coppicemen! I won't! Too close! Too close!" What was too close, Jack Sawyer refuses to consider. The echo proves that he must avoid any further contamination. Bad news for Dale, he knows. And he regrets both his inability to join the investigation and to explain his refusal to his friend. Dale's ass is on the line, no two ways about it. He is a good chief of police, more than good enough for French Landing. But he misjudged the politics and let the Stadies set him up. With every appearance of respect for local authority, State Detectives Brown and Black had bowed low, stepped aside, and permitted Dale Gilbertson, who thought they were doing him a favor, to slip a noose around his neck. Too bad, but Dale has just figured out that he is standing on a trap door with a black bag over his face. If the fisherman murders one more kid... Well, Jack Sawyer sends his most profound regrets. He can't perform a miracle right now, sorry. Jack has more pressing matters on his mind. Red feathers, for example. Small ones. Little red feathers are much on Jack's mind, and have been, despite his efforts to magic them away, since a month before the murder started. One morning as he emerged from his bedroom and began to go down to fix breakfast, a single red feather, a plume smaller than a baby's finger, seemed to float out of the slanted ceiling at the top of the stairs. In its wake, two or three others came drifting toward him. An oval section of plaster 2 inches across seemed to blink and open like an eye, and the eye released a tight, fat column of feathers that zoomed out of the ceiling as if propelled through a straw. A feather explosion, a feather hurricane, battered his chest, his raised arms, his head. But this never happened. Something else happened. And it took him a minute or two to figure it out. A wayward brain neuron misfired. A mental receptor lapped up the wrong chemical, or lapped up too much of the right chemical. The switches that nightly triggered the image conduits responded to a false signal and produced a waking dream. The waking dream resembled an hallucination. But hallucinations were experienced by wet brain alcoholics, drug takers, and crazy people, specifically paranoid schizophrenics, with whom Jack had dealt on many an occasion during his life as a coppiceman. Jack fit into none of those categories, including the last. He knew he was not a paranoid schizophrenic or any other variety of madman. If you thought Jack Sawyer was crazy, you were. He has complete... at least 99% complete faith in his sanity. Since he is not delusional, the feathers must have flown toward him in a waking dream. The only other explanation involves reality, and the feathers had no connection to reality. What kind of world would this be if such things could happen to us? Abruptly, George Rathbun bellows, "It pains me to say this, truly it does, for I love our dear old brew crew, you know I do, but there come times when love must grit its teeth and face a painful reality. For example, take the sorrowful state of our pitching staff, Bud Selig. Oh, Bud, this is Houston calling. Could you please return to Earth immediately? A blind man could throw more strikes than that aggregation of wimps, losers, and airheads." Good old Henry. Henry has George Rathbun down so perfectly you can see the sweat stains under his armpits. But the best of Henry's inventions, in Jack's opinion, has to be that embodiment of hipster cool, the laid-back, authoritative Henry Shake, the chic, the shake, the shook of Araby, who can, if in the mood, tell you the color of the socks worn by Lester Young on the day he recorded Shoeshine Boy and Lady Be Good, and describe the interiors of 2 dozen famous but mostly long-departed jazz clubs. And before we get into the very cool, very beautiful, very simpatico music whispered one Sunday at the Village Vanguard by the Bill Evans Trio, we might pay our respects to the third inner eye. Let us honor the inner eye, the eye of imagination. It is late in a hot July afternoon in Greenwich Village, New York City. On sun-dazzled 7th Avenue South, we stroll into the shade of the Vanguard's marquee, open a white door, and proceed down a long, narrow flight of stairs to a roomy underground cave. The musicians climb onto the stand. Bill Evans slides onto the piano bench and nods at the audience. Scott LaFaro hugs his bass. Paul Motion picks up his brushes. Evans lowers his head way, way down and drops his hands on the keyboard. For those of us who are privileged to be there, nothing will ever be the same again. My Foolish Heart by the Bill Evans Trio, live at the Village Vanguard, the 25th of June, 1961. I am your host, Henry Shake, the Sheik, the Sheik, the Shook of Araby. Smiling, Jack pours the beaten eggs into the frying pan, twice swirls them with a fork, and marginally reduces the gas flame. It occurs to him that he has neglected to make coffee. Nuts to coffee. Coffee is the last thing he needs. He can drink orange juice. A glance at the toaster suggests that he has also neglected to prepare the morning's toast. Does he require toast? Is toast essential? Consider the butter. Consider slabs of cholesterol waiting to corrupt his arteries. The omelet is risky enough. In fact, he has the feeling he cracked way too many eggs. Now Jack cannot remember why he wanted to make an omelet in the first place. He rarely eats omelets. In fact, he tends to buy eggs out of a sense of duty aroused by the two rows of egg-sized depressions near the top of his refrigerator door. If people were not supposed to buy eggs, why would refrigerators come with egg holders? He nudges a spatula under the edges of the hardening but still runny eggs, tilts the pan to slide them around, scrapes in the mushrooms and scallions, and folds the result in half. All right. Okay, looks good. A luxurious 40 minutes of freedom stretches out before him. In spite of everything, he seems to be functioning pretty well. Control is not an issue here. Unfolded on the kitchen table, the La Riviere Herald catches Jack's eye. He has forgotten about the newspaper. The newspaper has not forgotten him, however, and demands its proper share of attention. Fisherman still at large in, and so on. Arctic Circle would be nice, but no. He moves nearer to the table and sees that the fisherman remains a stubbornly local problem. From beneath the headline, Wendell Green's name leaps up and lodges in his eye like a pebble. Wendell Green is an all-around comprehensive pest, an ongoing irritant. After reading the first two paragraphs of Green's article, Jack groans and clamps a hand over his eyes. I'm a blind man. Make me an umpire. Wendell Green has the confidence of a small-town athletic hero who never left home. Tall, expansive, with a crinkly mat of red-blonde hair and a senatorial waistline, Green swaggers through the bars, the courthouses, the public arenas of La Riviere and its surrounding communities, distributing wised-up charm. Wendell Green is a reporter who knows how to act like one, an old-fashioned print journalist, the Herald's great ornament. At their first encounter, the great ornament struck Jack as a third-rate phony, and he has seen no reason to change his mind since then. He distrusts Wendell Green. In Jack's opinion, the reporter's gregarious facade conceals a limitless capacity for treachery. Green is a blowhard posturing in front of a mirror, but a canny blowhard, and such creatures will do anything to gain their own ends. After Thornburg Kinderling's arrest, Green requested an interview. Jack turned him down as he declined the three invitations that followed his removal to Norway Valley Road. His refusals had not deterred the reporter from staging occasional accidental meetings. The day after the discovery of Amy St. Pierre's body, Jack emerged from a Chase Street dry cleaner's shop with a box of freshly laundered shirts under his arm, began walking toward his car, and felt a hand close on his elbow. He looked back and beheld, contorted into a leer of spurious delight, the florid public mask of Wendell Green. "Hey, hey, Holly!" a bad boy smirked. "I mean, Lieutenant Sawyer. Hey, I'm glad I ran into you. This where you have your shirts done? They do a good job. If you leave out the part about the buttons." "Good one. You're a funny guy, Lieutenant. Let me give you a tip. Reliable. On 3rd Street in La Riviere, they live up to their name. No smashy, no breaky. Want your shirts done right? Go to a chink every time. Sam Lee, try him out, Lieutenant." "I'm not a lieutenant anymore, Wendell. Call me Jack or Mr. Sawyer. Call me Hollywood. I don't care." And now he walked toward his car, and Wendell Green walked beside him. "Any chance of a few words, Lieutenant?" "Sorry, Jack. Chief Gilbertson is a close friend of yours, I know, and this tragic case, little girl apparently mutilated, terrible things. Can you offer us your expertise? Step in, give us the benefit of your thoughts." "You want to know my thoughts?" "Anything you can tell me, buddy." Pure, irresponsible malice inspired Jack to extend an arm over Green's shoulders and say, "Wendell, old buddy, check out a guy named Albert Fish. It was back in the 20s. "Fish? F-I-S-H, from an old-line WASP New York family. An amazing case. Look it up. Until that moment, Jack had been barely conscious of remembering the outrages committed by the bizarre Mr. Albert Fish. Butchers more up-to-date, Ted Bundy, John Wayne Gacy, and Jeffrey Dahmer, had eclipsed Albert Fish, not to mention exotics like Edmund Emile Kemper III, who after committing 8 murders decapitated his mother, propped her head on his mantle, and used it as a dartboard. By way of explanation, Edmund III said this seemed appropriate. Yet the name of Albert Fish, an obscure back number, had surfaced in Jack's mind, and into Wendell Green's ready ear he had uttered it. What had gotten into him? Well, that was the question, wasn't it? Whoops, the omelet. Jack grabs a plate from the cabinet, silverware from a drawer, jumps to the stove, turns off the burner, and slides the mess in the pan onto his plate. He sits down and opens the Herald to page 5, where he reads about Millie Kuby's nearly winning 3rd place at the big statewide spelling bee, but for the substitution of an I for an A in Apopanax, the kind of thing that is supposed to be in a local paper. How can you expect a kid to spell Apopanax correctly anyhow? Jack takes 2 or 3 bites of his omelet before the peculiar taste in his mouth distracts him from the monstrous unfairness done to Millie Kuby. The funny taste is like half-burned garbage. He spits the food out of his mouth and sees a wad of gray mush and raw, half-chewed vegetables. The uneaten part of his breakfast does not look any more appetizing. He did not cook this omelet. He ruined it. He drops his head and groans. A shudder, like a loose electrical wire, travels here and there through his body, throwing off sparks that singe his throat, his lungs, his suddenly palpitating organs. Apopanax, he thinks. I'm falling apart. Right here and now. Forget I said that. The savage Apopanax has gripped me in its claws, shaken me with the fearful Apopanax of its Apopanax arms, and intends to throw me into the turbulent Apopanax river where I shall meet my Apopanax. What is happening to me? He says aloud. The shrill sound of his voice scares him. Apopanax tears sting his Apopanax eyes, and he gets groaning up off his Apopanax, dumps the swill into the garbage disposal, rinses the plate, and decides that it is damn well time to start making sense around here. Apopanax me, no Apopanaxes. Everybody makes mistakes. Jack examines the door of the refrigerator, trying to remember if he still has an egg or two in there. Sure he does, a whole bunch of eggs, about 9 or 10, had nearly filled the entire row of egg-shaped depressions at the top of the door. He could not have squandered all of them, he wasn't that out of it. Jack closes his fingers around the edge of the refrigerator door. Entirely unbidden, the vision of lights reflected in a black man's bald head. Not you. The person being addressed is not present. The person being addressed is scarcely a person at all. No. No, not you. The door swings open under the pressure of his fingers. The refrigerator light illuminates the laden shelves. Jack Sawyer regards the egg holders. They appear to be empty. A closer look reveals, nested within the rounded depression at the end of the first row, the presence of a small, egg-shaped object, colored a pale and delicate shade of blue. A nostalgic, tender blue, quite possibly the half-remembered blue of a summer sky observed in early afternoon by a small boy lying face up on the quarter acre of grass located behind a nice residential property on Roxbury Drive in Beverly Hills, California. Whoever owns this residential property, boy, you can put your money on one thing. They're in the entertainment business. Jack knows the name of this precise shade of blue due to an extended consideration of color samples undertaken in the company of Claire Evinrude, M.D., an oncologist of lovely and brisk dispatch, during the period when they were planning to repaint their then-shared bungalow in the Hollywood Hills. Claire, Dr. Evinrude, had marked this color for the master bedroom. He, recently returned from a big-deal, absurdly selective VICAP course of instruction at Quantico, Virginia, and newly promoted to the rank of lieutenant, had dismissed it as, well, maybe a little cold. Jack, Have you ever seen an actual robin's egg? Dr. Evinrude inquired. Do you have any idea how beautiful they are? Dr. Evinrude's gray eyes enlarged as she grasped her mental scalpel. Jack inserts two fingers into the egg receptacle and lifts from it the small egg-shaped object the color of a robin's egg. What do you know? This is a robin's egg. An actual, in the words of Dr. Claire Evinrude, robin's egg, hatched from the body of a robin, sometimes called a robin redbreast. He deposits the egg in the palm of his left hand. There it sits, this pale blue oblate, the size of a pecan. The capacity for thought seems to have left him. What the hell did he do, buy a robin's egg? Sorry, no, this relationship isn't working. The Apopanax is out of whack. Roy's store doesn't sell robin's eggs. I'm gone. Slowly, stiffly, awkward as a zombie, Jack progresses across the kitchen floor and reaches the sink. He extends his left hand over the maw at the sink's center and releases the robin's egg. Down into the garbage disposal it drops irretrievably. His right hand switches the machine into action with the usual noisy results. Growl, grind, snarl. A monster is enjoying a nice little snack. Grrr. The live electrical wire shudders within him, shedding sparks as it twitches, but he has become zombified and barely registers the internal shocks. All in all, taking everything into consideration, what Jack Sawyer feels most like doing at this moment, when the red, for some reason, he has not called his mother in a long, long while. He cannot think why he has not, and it is about time he did. Robin me no red robins. The voice of Lily Cavanaugh Sawyer, the Queen of the Bees, once his only companion in a rapture-flooded, transcendent, rigorously forgotten New Hampshire hotel room, is precisely the voice Jack needs to hear right about now. Lily Cavanaugh is the one person in the world to whom he can spill the ridiculous mess in which he finds himself. Despite the dim, unwelcome awareness of trespassing beyond the borders of strict rationality, and therefore bringing further into question his own uncertain sanity, he moves down the kitchen counter, picks up his cell phone, and punches in the number of the nice residential property on Roxbury Drive, Beverly Hills, California. The telephone in his old house rings 5 times, 6 times, 7. A man picks up, and in an angry, slightly drunken, sleep-distorted voice says, "Kimberly, whatever the hell this is about, for your sake, I hope it's really, really important." Jack hits end and snaps his phone shut. Oh, God, oh, hell, oh, damn. It is just past 5 a.m. in Beverly Hills or Westwood or Hancock Park or wherever that number now reaches. He forgot his mother was dead. Oh, hell. Oh, damn. Oh, God. Can you beat that? Jack's grief, which has been sharpening itself underground, once again rises up to stab him, as if for the first time, bang, dead center in the heart. At the same time, the idea that even for a second he could have forgotten that his mother was dead strikes him, God knows why, as hugely and irresistibly funny. How ridiculous can you get? The goofy stick has whapped him on the back of the head, and without knowing if he's going to burst into sobs or shouts of laughter, Jack experiences a brief wave of dizziness and leans heavily against the kitchen counter. "Jive-ass turkey," he remembers his mother saying. Lily had been describing her late husband's recently deceased partner in the days after her suspicious accountants discovered that the partner, Morgan Sloat, had been diverting into his own pockets 3/4 of the income from Sawyer and Sloat's astonishingly vast real estate holdings. Every year since Phil Sawyer's death in a so-called hunting accident, Sloat had stolen millions of dollars, many millions, from his late partner's family. Lily diverted the flow back into the proper channels and sold half the company to its new partners, in the process guaranteeing her son a tremendous financial bonanza, not to mention the annual bonanza that produces the interest Jack's private foundation funnels off to noble causes. Lily had called Sloat things far more colorful than jive-ass turkey, but that is the term her voice utters in his inner ear. Way back in May, Jack tells himself, he probably came across that robin's egg on an absent-minded stroll through the meadow and put it in the refrigerator for safekeeping, to keep it safe. Because, after all, it was of a delicate shade of blue, a beautiful blue, to quote Dr. Evinrude. So long had he kept it safe that he'd forgotten all about it, which he gratefully recognizes is why the waking dream presented him with an explosion of red feathers. Everything happens for a reason, concealed though the reason may be. Loosen up and relax long enough to stop being a jive-ass turkey, and the reason might come out of hiding. Jack bends over the sink, and for the sake of refreshment, internal and external, immerses his face in a double handful of cold water. For the moment, the cleansing shock washes away the ruined breakfast, the ridiculous telephone call, and the corrosive image flashes. It is time to strap on his skates and get going. In 25 minutes, Jack Sawyer's best friend and only confidant will, with his customary aura of rotary perception, emerge through the front door of KDCUAM's cinderblock building and, applying his golden lighter's flame to the tip of a cigarette, glide down the walkway to Peninsula Drive. Should rotary perception inform him that Jack Sawyer's pickup awaits, Henry Layden will unerringly locate the handle and climb in. This exhibition of blind man cool is too dazzling to miss. And miss it he does not. For in spite of the morning's difficulties, which from the balanced, mature perspective granted by his journey through the lovely countryside eventually seem trivial, Jack's pickup pulls up in front of the Peninsula Drive end of KDCUAM's walkway at 7:55, a good 5 minutes before his friend is to stroll out into the sunlight. Henry will be good for him. Just the sight of Henry will be like a dose of soul tonic. Surely Jack cannot be the first man or woman in the history of the world who momentarily lost his or her grip under stress and kind of halfway forgot that his or her mother had shuffled off the old mortal coil and departed for a higher sphere. Stressed-out mortals turned naturally to their mothers for comfort and reassurance. The impulses coded into our DNA. When he hears the story, Henry will chuckle and advise him to tighten his wig. On second thought, why cloud Henry's sky with a story so absurd? The same applies to the robin's egg, especially since Jack has not spoken to Henry about his waking dream of a feather eruption, and he does not feel like getting involved in a lot of pointless backtracking. Live in the present. Let the past stretch out in its grave. Keep your chin high and walk around the mud puddles. Don't look to your friends for therapy. He switches on the radio and hits the button for KWLA-FM, the UW La Riviere station, home to both the Wisconsin Rat and Henry the Sheik the Shake the Shook. What pours glittering from the cab's hidden speakers raises the hairs on his arms. Glenn Gould, inner eye luminously open, blazing through something by Bach. He could not say exactly what, but Glenn Gould, but Bach for sure, one of the partitas maybe. A CD jewel box in one hand, Henry Layden strolls through the humble doorway at the side of the station, enters the sunlight, and without hesitation begins to glide down the flagged walkway, the rubber soles of his Hershey Brown suede loafers striking the center of each successive flagstone. Henry is a vision. Today, Jack observes, Henry comes attired in one of his Malaysian teak forest owner ensembles, a handsome collarless shirt, shimmering braces, and an heirloom straw fedora creased to a fairly well. Had Jack not been so welcomed into Henry's life, he would not have known that his friend's capacity for flawless wardrobe assemblage depended upon the profound organization of his enormous walk-in closet, long ago established by Rhoda Gilbertson Layden, Henry's deceased wife. Rhoda had arranged every article of her husband's clothing by season, style, and color. Item by item, Henry memorized the entire system. Although blind since birth, therefore incapable of distinguishing between matching and mismatching shades, Henry never errs. Henry extracts from his shirt pocket a gold lighter and a yellow pack of American Spirits, fires up, exhales a radiant cloud brightened by sunlight to the color of milk, and continues his unwavering progress down the flagstones. The pink, back-slanting capitals of Troy Loves Marianne, yes, sprayed across the sign on the bare lawn, suggest that, one, Troy spends a lot of time listening to KDCUAM, and, two, Marianne loves him back. Good for Troy, good for Marianne. Jack applauds Love's announcement, even in pink spray paint, and wishes the lovers happiness and good fortune. It occurs to him that if at this present stage of his existence he could be said to love anyone, that person would have to be Henry Layden. Not in the sense that Troy loves Mary Ann, or vice versa, but he loves him all the same, a matter that has never been as clear as it is this moment. Henry traverses the last of the flagstones and approaches the curb. A single stride brings him to the door of the pickup. His hand closes on the recessed metal bar. He opens the door, steps up, and slides in. His head tilts, cocking his right ear to the music. The dark lenses of his aviator glasses shine. "How can you do that?" Jack asked. This time the music helped, but you don't need music. "I can do that because I am totally, totally bitch-rod," Henry says. "I learned that lovely word from our pothead intern, Morris Rosen, who kindly applied it to me. Morris thinks I am God, but he must have something on the ball because he figured out that George Rathbun and the Wisconsin Rat are one and the same. I hope the kid keeps his mouth shut." "I do too," Jack says, "but I'm not going to let you change the subject. How can you always open the door right away? How do you find the handle without groping for it?" Henry sighs. "The handle tells me where it is. Obviously, all I have to do is listen to it." "The door handle makes a sound?" "Not like your high-tech radio and the Goldberg variations, no. More like a vibration. The sound of a sound. The sound inside a sound. Isn't Daniel Barenboim a great piano player? Man, listen to that. Every note, a different coloration, makes you want to kiss the lid of his Steinway, baby. Imagine the muscles in his hands." "That's Barenboim?" "Well, who else could it be?" Slowly Henry turns his head to Jack. An irritating smile raises the corners of his mouth. "Ah, I see, yes. Knowing you as I do, you poor schmuck, I see you imagined you were listening to Glenn Gould." "I did not," Jack says. "Please. Maybe for a minute I wondered if it was Gould, but don't even try. Your voice gives you away. There's a little whiny topspin on every word. It's so pathetic. Are we going to drive back to Norway Valley, or would you like to sit here and keep lying to me? I want to tell you something on the way home." He holds up the CD. "Let's put you out of your misery. The pothead gave this to me, Dirty Sperm, doing an old Supremes ditty. Me, I loathe that sort of thing, but it might be perfect for the Wisconsin Rat. Cue up track 7. The pianist no longer sounds anything like Glenn Gould, and the music seems to have slowed to half its former velocity. Jack puts himself out of his misery and inserts the CD into the opening beneath the radio. He pushes a button, then another. At an insanely fast tempo, the screeches of madmen subjected to unspeakable tortures comes blasting out of the speakers. Jack rocks backward into the seat, jolted. "My God, Henry," he says, and reaches for the volume control. "Don't dare touch that dial," Henry says. "If this crap doesn't make your ears bleed, it isn't doing its job." Ears, Jack knows, is jazz speak for the capacity to hear what is going on in music as it unfurls across the air. A musician with good ears soon memorizes the songs and arrangements he is asked to play, picks up or already knows the harmonic movement underlying the theme, and follows the transformations and substitutions to that pattern introduced by his fellow musicians. Whether or not he can accurately read notes written on a staff, a musician with great ears learns melodies and arrangements the first time he hears them, grasps harmonic intricacies through flawless intuition, and immediately identifies the notes and key signatures registered by taxi horns, elevator bells, and mewing cats. Such people inhabit a world defined by the particularities of individual sounds, and Henry Layden is one of them. As far as Jack is concerned, Henry's ears are Olympian, in a class by themselves. It was Henry's ears that gave him access to Jack's great secret, the role his mother, Lily Cavanaugh Sawyer, Lily Cavanaugh, had occupied in life, and he is the only person ever to discover it. Shortly after Dale introduced them, Jack and Henry Layden entered into an easy, companionable friendship surprising to both. Each the answer to the other's loneliness, They spent 2 or 3 nights of every week having dinner together, listening to music and talking about whatever came into their well-stocked minds. Either Jack drove down the road to Henry's eccentric house, or he picked Henry up and drove him back to his place. After something like 6 or 7 months, Jack wondered if his friend might enjoy spending an hour or so listening to him read aloud from books agreed upon by both parties. Henry replied, "Ivy Divey, my man, what a beautiful idea. How about starting with some whacked-out crime novels?" They began with Chester Himes and Charles Williford, changed gear with a batch of contemporary novels, floated through S.J. Perelman and James Thurber, and ventured emboldened into fictional mansions erected by Ford Madox Ford and Vladimir Nabokov. Marcel Proust lies somewhere ahead, they understand, but Proust can wait. At present, they are to embark upon Bleak House. One night after Jack had finished the evening's installment of Ford's The Good Soldier, Henry cleared his throat and said, "Dale said you told him your parents were in the entertainment industry, in show business." "That's right. I don't want to pry, but would you mind if I asked you some questions? If you feel like answering, just say yes or no." Already alarmed, Jack said, "What's this about, Henry?" "I want to see if I'm right about something." "Okay, ask." "Thank you. Were your parents in different aspects of the industry?" "Was one of them in the business end of things and the other a performer?" "Was your mother an actress?" "A famous actress, in a way. She never really got the respect she deserved, but she made a ton of movies all through the 50s and into the mid-60s, and at the end of her career she won an Oscar for Best Supporting Actress." "Henry," Jack said, "where did you clam up? I intend to relish this moment. Your mother was Lily Cavanaugh. That's wonderful. Lily Cavanaugh was always so much more talented than most people gave her credit for. Every time out she brought those roles she played, those girls, those tough little waitresses and dames with guns in their handbags, up to a new level. Beautiful, smart, gutsy, no pretensions, just lock in and inhabit the part. She was about 100 times better than anyone else around her. Henry, some of those movies had nice soundtracks, too. Lost Summer, Johnny Mandel, out of sight." "Henry, how did you told me? How else could I know? These little things your voice does, that's how. You slide over the tops of your R's, and you hit the rest of your consonants in a kind of cadence, and that cadence runs through your sentences." "A cadence? Bet your ass, Junior. An underlying rhythm, like your own personal drummer. All through The Good Soldier, I kept trying to remember where I'd heard it before. Faded in, faded back out. A couple of days ago, I nailed it. Lily Cavanaugh. You can't blame me for wanting to see if I was right, can you?" "Blame you?" Jack said. "I'm too stunned to blame anybody. But give me a couple of minutes." "Your secret's safe. When people see you, you don't want their first thought to be, 'Hey, there's Lily Cavanaugh's son.' Makes sense to me." "Henry Layden has great ears, all right." As the pickup rolls through French Landing, the din filling the cab makes conversation impossible. Dirty sperm is burning a hole through the marzipan center of Where Did Our Love Go, and in the process committing hideous atrocities upon all those cute little supremes. Henry, who claims to loathe this kind of thing, slouches in his seat, knees up on the dash, hands steepled below his chin, grinning with pleasure. The shops on Chase Street have opened for business, and half a dozen cars jut at an angle from parking spaces. 4 boys astride bicycles swerve off the sidewalk before Schmidt's All Sorts and into the road 20 feet in front of the moving pickup. Jack hits his brakes. The boys come to an abrupt halt and line up side by side, waiting for him to pass. Jack trolls forward. Henry straightens up, checks his mysterious sensors, and drops back into position. All is well with Henry. The boys, however, do not know what to make of the uproar growing ever louder as the pickup approaches. They stare at Jack's windshield in bafflement tinged with distaste, the way their great-grandfathers once stared at the Siamese twins and the alligator man in the freak show at the back of the fairground. Everybody knows that the drivers of pickup trucks listen to only 2 kinds of music, heavy metal or country, so what's with this creep? As Jack drives past the boys, the first, a scowling heavyweight with the inflamed face of a schoolyard bully, displays an upraised second finger. The next two continue the imitations of their great-grandfathers having a hot night out in 1921, and gape, idiotically, mouths slack and open. The fourth boy, whose dark blonde hair beneath a brewer's cap, bright eyes, and general air of innocence make him the nicest-looking of the group, gazes directly into Jack's face and gives him a sweet, tentative smile. This is Tyler Marshall out for a spin, though he is completely unaware of it, into no man's land. The boys glide into the background, and Jack glances into the mirror to see them pedaling furiously up the street, Sluggo in front, the smallest, most appealing one in the rear already falling behind. A sidewalk panel of experts has reported in on the dirty sperm, Jack says, 4 kids on bikes. Since he can scarcely make out his words, he does not think Henry will be able to hear them at all. Henry, it seems, has heard him perfectly, and he responds with a question that disappears into the uproar. Having a reasonably good idea of what it must have been, Jack answers it anyhow. 1 firm negative, 2 undecideds tending toward negative, and 1 cautious positive. Henry nods. Violent marzipan destruction crashes and thuds to a conclusion on 11th Street. As if a haze has blown from the cab, as if the windshield has been freshly washed, the air seems clearer, the colors more vibrant. Interesting, Henry says. He reaches unerringly for the eject button, extracts the disc from the holder, and slips it into his case. That was very revealing, don't you think? Raw, self-centered hatred should never be dismissed automatically. Morris Rosen was right. It's perfect for the Wisconsin rat. Hey, I think they could be bigger than Glenn Miller. That reminds me, Henry says. You'll never guess what I'm doing later. I have a gig. Chipper Maxton, actually his second-in-command, this Rebecca Vilas woman, who I am sure is as gorgeous as she sounds, hired me to put on a record hop as the slam-bang climax to Maxton's big strawberry fest. Well, not me. An old, long-neglected persona of mine, Symphonic Stan, the big band man. Do you need a ride? I do not. The wondrous Miss Vilas has attended to my needs, in the form of a car with a comfy back seat for my turntable, and a trunk spacious enough for the speakers and record cartons, which she will be sending. But thanks anyhow. Symphonic Stan, Jack said. A knocked-out, all-frantic, all-zoot-suit embodiment of the big band era, and a charming, mellifluous gentleman besides, for the residents of Maxton's, an evocation of their salad days, and a joy to behold. Do you actually own a zoot-suit? Magnificently inexpressive, Henry's face swings toward him. Sorry, I don't know what came over me. To change the subject, what you said... I mean, what George Rathbun said about the fishermen this morning probably did a lot of good. I was glad to hear that. Henry opens his mouth and summons George Rathbun in all his avuncular glory. The original fisherman, boys and girls, Albert Fish, has been dead and gone for 67 years. It is uncanny hearing the voice of that charged-up fat man leap from Henry Layden's slender throat. In his own voice, Henry says, I hope it did some good. After I read your buddy Wendell Green's nonsense in the paper this morning, I thought George had to say something. Henry Layden enjoys using terms like I read, I was reading, I saw, I was looking at. He knows these phrases disconcert his auditors. And he called Wendell Green your buddy because Henry is the only person to whom Jack has ever admitted that he alerted the reporter to the crimes of Albert Fish. Now Jack wishes he had confessed to no one. Glad-handing Wendell Green is not his buddy. Having been of some assistance to the press, Henry says, you might reasonably be thought in a position to do the same for our boys in blue. Forgive me, Jack, but you open the door, and I'll only say this once. Dale is my nephew, after all. I don't believe you're doing this to me, Jack says. Doing what, speaking my mind? Dale is my nephew, remember. He could use your expertise, and he is very much of the opinion that you owe him a favor. Hasn't it occurred to you that you could help him stay in his job? Or that if you love French Landing and Norway Valley as much as you say, you owe these folks a little of your time and talent? Hasn't it occurred to you, Henry, that I'm retired, Jack says through gritted teeth, that investigating homicides is the last thing, I mean the last thing in the world I want to do? Of course it has, Henry says. But, and again, I hope you'll forgive me, Jack. Here you are, the person I know you are, with the skills you have, which are certainly far beyond Dale's and probably well beyond all these other guys, and I can't help wondering what the hell your problem is. I don't have a problem, Jack says. I'm a civilian. You're the boss. We might as well listen to the rest of the Baron Boyme. Henry runs his fingers over the console and pushes the button for the tuner. For the next 15 minutes, the only voice to be heard in the pickup's cab is that of a Steinway concert grand meditating upon the Goldberg variations in the Teatro Colón, Buenos Aires. A splendid voice it is, too, Jack thinks, and you'd have to be an ignoramus to mistake it for Glenn Gould. A person capable of making that mistake probably couldn't hear the vibration-like inner sound produced by a General Motors door handle. When they turn right off Highway 93 into Norway Valley Road, Henry says, "Stop sulking. I shouldn't have called you a schmuck. And I shouldn't have accused you of having a problem because I'm the one with the problem." "You?" Jack looks at him, startled. Long experience has immediately suggested that Henry is about to ask for some kind of unofficial investigative help. Henry is facing the windshield, giving nothing away. "What kind of problem can you have? Did your socks get out of order? Oh, are you having trouble with one of the stations?" "That I could deal with." Henry pauses, and the pause stretches into a lengthy silence. "What I was going to say is, I feel like I'm losing my mind. I think I'm going sort of crazy." "Come on." Jack eases up on the gas pedal and cuts his speed in half. "Has Henry witnessed a feather explosion?" Of course he hasn't. Henry cannot see anything, and his own feather explosion was merely a waking dream. Henry quivers like a tuning fork. He is still facing the windshield. "Tell me what's going on," Jack says. "I'm starting to worry about you." Henry opens his mouth to a crack that might accommodate a communion wafer, then closes it again. Another tremor runs through him. "Hmm," he says. "This is harder than I thought." Astonishingly, his dry, measured voice, the true voice of Henry Layden, wobbles with a wide, helpless vibrato. Jack slows the pickup to a crawl, begins to say something, and decides to wait. "I hear my wife," Henry says, "at night when I'm lying in bed, around 3-4 in the morning. Rhoda's footsteps are moving around in the kitchen. They're coming up the stairs. I must be losing my mind." "How often does this happen?" "How many times? I don't know exactly. 3 or 4. "Do you get up and look for her? Call out her name?" Henry's voice again sails up and down on the vibrato trampoline. "I've done both those things, because I was sure I heard her. Her footsteps, her way of walking, her tread. Rhoda's been gone for 6 years now. Pretty funny, huh? I'd think it was funny if I didn't think I was going bats." "You call out her name," Jack says, "and you get out of bed and go downstairs." "Like a lunatic. Like a madman. Rhoda, is that you, Rhoda? Last night I went all around the house. Rhoda, Rhoda, you'd think I was expecting her to answer." Henry pays no attention to the tears that leak from beneath his aviator glasses and slip down his cheeks. "And I was. That's the problem." "No one else was in the house," Jack says. "No signs of disturbance, nothing misplaced or missing or anything like that." "Not as far as I saw. Everything was still where it should have been, right where I left it." He raises a hand and wipes his face. The entrance to Jack's looping driveway slides past on the right side of the cab. "I'll tell you what I think," Jack says, picturing Henry wandering through his darkened house. "6 years ago, you went through all the grief business that happens when someone you love dies and leaves you. The denial, the bargaining, the anger, the pain, whatever, acceptance, that whole range of emotions. But afterward, you still missed Rhoda. No one ever says you keep on missing the dead people you loved, but you do." "Now that's profound," Henry says, "and comforting, too. Don't interrupt. Weirdness happens. Believe me, I know what I'm talking about." Your mind rebels. It distorts the evidence. It gives false testimony. Who knows why? It just does. In other words, you go batshit, Henry says. I believe that is where we came in. What I mean, Jack says, is that people can have waking dreams. That's what is happening to you. It's nothing to worry about. All right, here's your drive. You're home. He turns into the grassy entrance and rolls up to the white farmhouse in which Henry and Rhoda Layden had spent the 15 lively years between their marriage and the discovery of Rhoda's liver cancer. For nearly 2 years after her death, Henry went wandering through his house every evening, turning on the lights. Waking dreams? Where'd you get that one? Waking dreams aren't uncommon, Jack says, especially in people who never get enough sleep, like you. Or like me, he silently adds. I'm not making this up, Henry. I've had one or two myself. One, anyhow. Waking dreams, Henry says in a different, considering tone of voice. Ivy-divy. Think about it. We live in a rational world. People do not return from the dead. Everything happens for a reason, and the reasons are always rational. It's a matter of chemistry or coincidence. If they weren't rational, we'd never figure anything out, and we'd never know what was going on. Even a blind man can see that, Henry says. Thanks. Words to live by. He gets out of the cab and closes the door. He moves away, steps back, and leans in through the window. Do you want to start on Bleak House tonight? I should get home about 8:30, something like that. I'll turn up around 9. By way of parting, Henry says, ding dong. He turns away, walks to his doorstep, and disappears into his house, which is, of course, unlocked. Around here, only parents lock their doors, and even that's a new development. Jack reverses the pickup, swings down the drive, and onto Norway Valley Road. He feels as though he has done a doubly good deed, for by helping Henry, he has also helped himself. It's nice how things turn out sometimes. When he turns into his own long driveway, a peculiar rattle comes from the ashtray beneath his dashboard. He hears it again at the last curve, just before his house comes into view. The sound is not so much a rattle as a small, dull clunk. A button, a coin, something like that. He rolls to a stop at the side of his house, turns off the engine, and opens his door. On an afterthought, he reaches over and pulls out the ashtray. What Jack finds, nestled in the grooves at the bottom of the sliding tray, a tiny robin's egg, a robin's egg the size of an almond M&M, expels all the air from his body. The little egg is so blue, a blind man could see it. Jack's trembling fingers pluck the egg from the ashtray. Staring at it, he leaves the cab and closes the door. Still staring at the egg, he finally remembers to breathe. His hand revolves on his wrist and releases the egg, which falls in a straight line to the grass. Deliberately, he lifts his foot and smashes it down onto the obscene blue speck. Without looking back, he pockets his keys and moves toward the dubious safety of his house. Part 2. The Taking of Tyler Marshall. Chapter 5. We glimpsed a janitor on our whirlwind early morning tour of Maxton Elder Care. Do you happen to remember him? Baggy overalls a wee bit thick in the gut, dangling cigarette in spite of the no-smoking lungs-at-work signs that have been posted every 20 feet or so along the patient corridors, a mop that looks like a clot of dead spiders. No? Don't apologize. It's easy enough to overlook Pete Wexler, a one-time nondescript youth, final grade average at French Landing High School 79, who passed through a nondescript young manhood and has now reached the edge of what he expects to be a nondescript middle age. His only hobby is administering the occasional secret savage pinch to the moldy oldies that fill his days with their grunts, nonsensical questions, and smells of gas and piss. The Alzheimer's assholes are the worst. He has been known to stub out the occasional cigarette on their scrawny backs or buttocks. He likes their strangled cries when the heat hits and the pain cores in. This small and ugly torture has a double-barreled effect. It wakes them up a little and satisfies something in him. Brightens his days, somehow. Refreshes the old outlook. Besides, who are they going to tell? And, oh, God, there goes the worst of them now, shuffling slowly down the corridor of Daisy. Charles Burnside's mouth is agape, as is the back of his Johnny. Pete has a better view of Burnside's scrawny, shit-smeared buttocks than he ever wanted. The chocolate stains go all the way down to the backs of his knees, by God. He's headed for the bathroom, but it's just a little bit late. A certain brown horse, call him Morning Thunder, has already bolted from its stall and no doubt galloped across Bernie's sheets. Thank God cleaning him up isn't my job, Pete thinks, and smirks around his cigarette. Over to you, Butch. But the desk up there by the little boys' and girls' rooms is, for the time being, unattended. Butch Yerxa is going to miss the charming sight of Bernie's dirty ass sailing by. Butch has apparently stepped out for a smoke. Although Pete has told the idiot 100 times that all those no-smoking signs mean nothing, Chipper Maxton could care less about who smoked where, or where the smokes were butted out, for that matter. The signs are just there to keep good old drooler manner in compliance with certain tiresome state laws. Pete's smirk widens, and at that moment he looks a good deal like his son, Ebby, Tyler Marshall's sometime friend. It was Ebby Wexler, in fact, who just gave Jack and Henry the finger. Pete is wondering whether he should go out and tell Butch he's got a little cleanup job in D-18, plus D-18's occupant, of course, or if he should just let Butch discover Bernie's latest mess on his own. Perhaps Bernie will go back to his room and do a little finger painting, kind of spread the joy around. That would be good, but it would also be good to see Butch's face fall when Pete told him. Pete? Oh, no, sandbagged by the bitch. She's a fine-looking bitch, but a bitch is still a bitch. Pete stands where he is for a moment, thinking that maybe if he ignores her, she'll go away. Vain hope. Pete. He turns. There is Rebecca Vilas, current squeeze of the big cheese. Today she is wearing a light red dress, perhaps in honor of Strawberry Fest, and black high-heeled pumps, probably in honor of her own fine gams. Pete briefly imagines those fine gams wrapped around him, those high heels crossed at the small of his back and pointing like clock hands, then sees the cardboard box she's holding in her arms. Work for him, no doubt. Pete also notes the glinting ring on her finger, some sort of gemstone the size of a goddamn robin's egg, although considerably paler. He wonders, not for the first time, just what a woman does to earn a ring like that. She stands there, tapping her foot, letting him have his look. Behind him, Charles Burnside continues his slow, tottery progress toward the men's. You'd think, looking at that old wreck with his scrawny legs and flyaway milkweed hair, that his running days were long behind him. But you'd be wrong. Terribly wrong. "Miss Vilas?" Pete says at last. "Common room, Pete, on the double. And how many times have you been told not to smoke in the patient wings?" Before he can reply, she turns with a sexy little flirt of the skirt and starts off toward the Maxton common room, where that afternoon's Strawberry Fest dance will be held. Sighing, Pete props his broom against the wall and follows her. Charles Burnside is now alone at the head of the Daisy corridor. The vacancy leaves his eyes and is replaced with a brilliant and feral gleam of intelligence. All at once, he looks younger. All at once, Bernie the human shit machine is gone. In his place is Carl Beerstone, who reaped the young in Chicago with such savage efficiency. Carl, and something else. Something not human. It grins. On the unattended desk is a pile of paper weighed down with a round stone the size of a coffee cup. Written on the stone in small black letters is Butch's Pet Rock. Bernie picks up Butch Yerxa's pet rock and walks briskly toward the men's room, still grinning. In the common room, the tables have been arranged around the walls and covered with red paper cloths. Later, Pete will add small red lights, battery-powered, no candles for the droolers, gosh, no. On the walls, great big cardboard strawberries have been taped up everywhere, some looking rather battered. They have been put up and taken down every July since Herbert Maxton opened this place at the end of the swinging 60s. The linoleum floor is open and bare. This afternoon and early evening, the moldy oldies who are still ambulatory and of a mind to do so will shuffle around out there to the big band sounds of the 30s and 40s, clinging to each other during the slow numbers and probably dampening their depends with excitement at the end of the jitterbugs. 3 years ago, a moldy oldie named Irving Christie had a minor heart attack after doing a particularly strenuous Lindy Hop to Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree with Anyone Else But Me. Oh, yes, the Strawberry Fest Hop is always exciting. Rebecca has, all by herself, pushed together 3 wooden flats and covered them with a white cloth, creating the basis for Symphonic Stan's podium. In the corner stands a brilliantly chromed microphone with a large, round head, a genuine antique from the 30s that saw service at the Cotton Club. It is one of Henry Layden's prized possessions. Beside it is the tall, narrow carton in which it arrived yesterday. On the podium, beneath a beam decorated with red and white crepe and more cardboard strawberries, is a stepladder. Seeing it, Pete feels a moment's possessive jealousy. Rebecca Vilas has been in his closet. Trespassing bitch! If she stole any of his weed, by God! Rebecca sets her carton down on the podium with an audible grunt, then straightens up. She brushes a lock of silky chestnut hair off one flushed cheek. It's only mid-morning, but the day is going to be a genuine coolie country scorcher. Air condition your underwear and double up on the deodorant, folks, as George Rathbun has been known to bellow. "I thought you'd never come, me fine bucko," Rebecca says. "Well, I'm here," Pete says sullenly. "Looks like you're doing fine without me." He pauses, then adds, "Fine." For Pete, this is quite a witticism. He walks forward and peers into the carton, which, like the one by the mic, is stamped property of Henry Layden. Inside the box is a small spotlight with an electrical cord wrapped around it and a circular pink gel that is meant to turn the light the color of candy canes and sugar strawberries. "What's this shit?" Pete asks. Rebecca gives him a brilliant, dangerous smile. Even to a relatively dull fellow like Pete, the message of that smile is clear. "You're on the edge of the gator pool, buddy. How many more steps do you want to take?" "Light," she says, L-I-G-H-T. "Hangs up there on that hook, H-O-O-K. It's something the DJ insists on. Says it gets him in the mood. M-O-O, what happened to Weenie Erickson?" Pete grumbles. "There was none of this shit with Weenie. He played the goddamn records for 2 hours, had a few out of his hip flask, then shut it down." "He moved," Rebecca says indifferently. "Racine, I think." "Well..." Pete is looking up, studying the beam with its intertwined fluffs of red and white crepe. "I don't see no hook, Miss Vilas." "Christ on a bicycle," she says, and mounts the stepladder. "Here, are you blind?" Pete, most definitely not blind, has rarely been so grateful for his sighted state. From his position below her, he's got a clear view of her thighs, the red lace froth of her panties, and the twin curves of her buttocks, now nicely tensed as she stands on the 5th step of the ladder. She looks down at him, sees the stunned look on his face, notes the direction of his sight line. Her expression softens a bit. As her dear mither so wisely observed, some men are just fools for a flash of panty. "Pete, earth to Pete." "Ah?" He looks up at her, mouth hanging agape, a dot of spittle on his lower lip. "There is no hook of any kind on my underwear. I'm sure of that as of few things in life. But if you will direct your gaze upward to my hand instead of my ass..." He looks up, face still dazed, and sees one red-tipped nail. Rebecca is a through-and-through vision in strawberry red today, no doubt about it. tapping a hook that just gleams out of the crepe, like a fisherman's hook gleaming murderously out of a gaudy lure. "Hook," she says, "attach gel to light, attach light to hook. Light becomes warm pink spotlight as per DJ's explicit instructions. You get a message, Kimosabe?"
Yeah.
"Then, if I may coin a phrase, will you please get it up?" She comes down the ladder, deciding Pete Wexler has gotten the biggest free show he can reasonably expect for one lousy chore. And Pete, who has already achieved one erection, pulls Symphonic Stan's pink pin spot out of its box and prepares to achieve another. As he mounts the stepladder, his crotch rises past Rebecca's face. She notes the bulge there and gnaws the inside of one cheek to suppress a smile. Men are fools, all right. Lovable fools, some of them, but fools all the same. It's just that some fools can afford rings and trips and midnight suppers at Milwaukee night spots, and some fools cannot. With some fools, the best you can get them to do is put up a lousy light. "Wait up, you guys," Time Marshall calls. "Ebby, Ronnie, TJ, wait up!" Over his shoulder, Ebby Wexler, who really does look like Nancy's not-too-bright boyfriend Sluggo, calls back, "Catch us, Slowpoke!"
"Yeah," Ronnie Metzger yells, "catch us, Po-Sloke!"
Ronnie, a kid with a lot of hours in the speech therapy room ahead of him, looks back over his own shoulder, almost crashes his bike into a parking meter, and just manages to swerve around it. Then they are fleeing, the three of them filling the sidewalk with their bikes. God help the pedestrian headed the other way, their racing shadows fleeing beside them. Tyler considers a final catch-up dash, then decides his legs are just too tired. His mother and father say that he will catch up in time, that he's just small for his age, but brother, Ty has his doubts. And he has had increasing doubts about Ebby, Ronnie, and TJ, too. Are they really worth keeping up with? If Judy Marshall knew of these doubts, she would stand and applaud. She has wondered for the last 2 years when her bright and thoughtful son will finally tire of hanging out with such a bunch of losers, what she calls low raiders.
"Suck an elf," Ty says disconsolately. He has picked up this harmless vulgarity from Sci-Fi Channel reruns of a miniseries called The Tenth Kingdom, and dismounts his bike. There's no real reason to speed after them anyway. He knows where he'll find them, in the parking lot of the 7-Eleven, drinking Slurpees and trading magic cards. This is another problem Tyler is having with his friends. These days, he'd much rather trade baseball cards. Ebby, Ronnie, and TJ could care less about the Cardinals, the Indians, the Red Sox, and the Brew Crew. Ebby has gone so far as to say that baseball is gay, a comment Ty considers stupid, almost pitiable, rather than outrageous. He walks his bike slowly up the sidewalk, catching his breath. Here is the intersection of Chase and Queen Streets. Ebby calls Queen Street Queer Street, of course, no surprise there, and isn't that a big part of the problem? Tyler is a boy who likes surprises. Ebby Wexler is a boy who doesn't, which makes their opposite reactions to the music pouring out of the pickup a little earlier that morning perfectly predictable. Tyler pauses at the corner, looking down Queen Street. There are shaggy hedges on both sides. Above those on the right rise a number of interconnected red roofs. The old folks' home. Beside the main gate, some sort of sign has been placed. Curious, Tyler remounts his bike and rides slowly down the sidewalk for a look. The longest branches of the hedge beside him whisper against the handlebar of his bike. The sign turns out to be a great big strawberry. "Strawberry Fest today" is written below it. What, Ty Marshall wonders, is a strawberry fest? A party, something strictly for old folks? It's a question, but not a very interesting one. After mulling it over for a few seconds, he turns his bike and prepares to ride back down to Chase Street. Charles Burnside enters the men's room at the head of the Daisy Corridor, still grinning and clutching Butch's pet rock. To his right is a line of sinks with a mirror over each one. They are the sort of metal mirrors one finds in the toilets of the lower-class bars and saloons. In one of these, Bernie sees his own grinning reflection. In another, the one closest the window, he sees a small boy in a Milwaukee Brewers t-shirt. The boy is standing astride his bike, just outside the gate, reading the Strawberry Fest sign. Bernie begins to drool. There is nothing discreet about it either. Bernie drools like a wolf in a fairy tale, white curds of foamy spit leaking from the corners of his mouth and flowing over the slack, liver-colored roll of his lower lip. The drool runs down his chin like a stream of soap suds. He wipes at it absently with the back of one gnarled hand and shakes it to the floor in a splatter, never taking his eyes from the mirror. The boy in the mirror is not one of this creature's poor lost babies. Time Marshall has lived in French Landing his whole life and knows exactly where he is. But he could be. He could very easily become lost and wind up in a certain room, a certain cell, or trudging toward a strange horizon on burning, bleeding footsies. Especially if Bernie has his way. He will have to move fast. But as we have already noted, Charles Burnside can, with the proper motivation, move very fast indeed. "Gorg," he says to the mirror. He speaks this nonsense word in a perfectly clear, perfectly flat Midwestern accent. "Come, Gorg." And without waiting to see what comes next, he knows what comes next, Bernie turns and walks toward the line of four toilet stalls. He steps into the second from the left and closes the door. Tyler has just remounted his bike when the hedge rustles 10 feet from the Strawberry Fest sign. A large black crow shrugs its way out of the greenery and onto the Queen Street sidewalk. It regards the boy with a lively, intelligent eye. It stands with its black legs spread, opens its beak, and speaks. "Gorg." Tyler looks at it, beginning to smile. Not sure he heard this, but ready to be delighted. At 10, he's always ready to be delighted, always primed to believe the unbelievable. "What? Did you say something?" The crow flutters its glossy wings and cocks its head in a way that renders the ugly almost charming. "Gorg. Ty." The boy laughs. It said his name. The crow said his name. He dismounts his bike, puts it on the kickstand, and takes a couple of steps toward the crow. Thoughts of Amy St. Pierre and Johnny Erkenham are, unfortunately, the furthest things from his mind. He thinks the crow will surely fly away when he steps toward it, but it only flutters its wings a little and takes a slide step toward the bushy darkness of the hedge. "Did you say my name?"
"Gorg, Ty, Abala."
For a moment, Ty's smile falters. That last word is almost familiar to him, and the associations, although faint, are not exactly pleasant. It makes him think of his mother for some reason. Then the crow says his name again. Surely it is saying Ty. Tyler takes another step away from Queen Street and toward the blackbird. The crow takes a corresponding step, sidling closer still to the bulk of the hedge. There is no one on the street. This part of French Landing is dreaming in the morning sunshine. Ty takes another step toward his doom, and all the worlds tremble. Ebby, Ronnie, and TJ come swaggering out of the 7-Eleven, where the raghead behind the counter has just served them blueberry slurpees. Raghead is just one of many pejorative terms Ebby has picked up from his dad. They also have fresh packs of magic cards, 2 packs each. Ebby, his lips already smeared blue, turns to TJ. "Go on down street and get the slowpoke." TJ looks injured. "Why me?" "Because Ronnie bought the cards, dumbwit. Go on, hurry up." "Why do we need him, Ebby?" Ronnie asks. He leans against the bike rack, noshing on the cold, sweet chips of ice. "Because I say so," Ebby replies loftily.
The fact is, Tyler Marshall usually has money on Fridays. In fact, Tyler has money almost every day. His parents are loaded. Abby, who is being raised, if you can call it that, by a single father who has a crappy janitor's job, has already conceived a vague hate for Tyler on this account. The first humiliations aren't far away, and the first beatings will follow soon after. But now all he wants are more magic cards, a third pack for each of them. The fact that Tyler doesn't even like magic that much will only make getting him to pony up that much sweeter. But first they have to get the little slowpoke up here, or the little po-sloke, as mush-mouthed Ronnie calls him. Abby likes that and thinks he'll start using it. Po-sloke, a good word, makes fun of Ty and Ronnie at the same time, two for the price of one. Go on, TJ, unless you want an Indian burn. TJ doesn't. Abby Wexler's Indian burns hurt like a mad bastard. He gives a theatrical sigh, backs his bike out of the rack, mounts it, and rides back down the mild slope of the hill, holding a handlebar in one hand and his Slurpee in the other. He expects to see Ty right away, probably walking his bike because he's just so tired. But Ty doesn't seem to be on Chase Street at all. What's up with that? TJ pedals a little faster. In the men's room, we are now looking at the line of toilet stalls. The door of the one second from the left is closed. The other three stand ajar on their chrome hinges. Beneath the closed door, we see a pair of gnarled, veiny ankles rising from a pair of filthy slippers. A voice cries out with surprising strength. It is a young man's voice, hoarse, hungry, and angry. It echoes flatly back from the tile walls. Abala, Abala Dune, Munchungorg. Suddenly the toilets flush. Not just the one in the closed cubicle, but all of them. Across the room, the urinals also flush, their chromed handles dipping in perfect synchronicity. Water runs down their curved porcelain surfaces. When we look back from the urinals to the toilets, we see that the dirty slippers and the feet that were in them are gone. And for the first time, we have actually heard the sound of slippage, a kind of hot exhale, the sort of sound one hears escaping one's lungs when waking from a nightmare at 2 in the morning. Ladies and gentlemen, Charles Burnside has left the building. The crow has backed right up against the hedge now. Still, it regards Tyler with its bright, eerie eyes. Tyler steps forward toward it, feeling hypnotized.
"Say my name again," he breathes. "Say my name again and you can go."
"Die," the crow croaks obligingly, then gives its wings a little shake and slips into the hedge. For a moment, Tyler can still see it, a mixture of shiny black and the shiny green, and then it's gone.
"Holy crow," Tyler says.
He realizes what he said and gives a small, shaky laugh.
Did it happen? It did, didn't it?
He leans closer to where the crow re-entered the hedge, thinking if it shed a feather, he will take it for a souvenir. And when he does, a scrawny white arm shoots out through the green and seizes him unerringly by the neck. Tyler has time to give a single terrified squawk, and then he is dragged through the hedge. One of his sneakers is pulled off by the short, stiff branches. From the far side, there is a single, guttural, greedy cry. It might have been, "Boy!" And then a thud, the sound of a pet rock coming down on a small boy's head, perhaps. Then there's nothing but the distant drone of a lawnmower and the closer drone of a bee. The bee is bumbling around the flowers on the far side of the hedge, the Maxton side. There is nothing else to be seen over there but green grass, and closer to the building, the tables where the elderly inhabitants will, at noon, sit down to the Strawberry Fest picnic. Tyler Marshall is gone. T.J. Reniker coasts to a stop at the corner of Chase and Queen. His Slurpee is dripping dark blue juice over his wrist, but he barely notices. Halfway down Queen Street, he sees Ty's bike leaning neatly over on its kickstand, but no Ty. Moving slowly, he has a bad feeling about this somehow. TJ rides over to the bike. At some point, he becomes aware that what was a Slurpee has now dissolved into a soggy cup of melting goop. He tosses it into the gutter. It's Ty's ride, all right. No mistaking that red 20-inch Schwinn with the ape hanger handlebars and the green Milwaukee Bucks decal on the side. The bike and... lying on its side, by the hedge that creates a border between the world of the old folks and the world of regular people, the real people, TJ sees a single Reebok sneaker lying on its side. Scattered around it are a number of shiny green leaves. One feather protrudes from the sneaker. The boy stares at this sneaker with wide eyes. TJ may not be as smart as Tyler, but he's a few watts brighter than Ebby Wexler, and it's easy enough for him to imagine Tyler being dragged through the hedge, leaving his bike behind, and one sneaker, one lonely, overturned sneaker. "Ty," he calls, "are you joking around? Because if you are, you better stop. I'll tell Ebby to give you the biggest Indian burn you ever had." No answer. Ty isn't joking around. TJ somehow knows it. Thoughts of Amy St. Pierre and Johnny Erkenham suddenly explode in TJ's mind. He hears, or imagines he hears, stealthy footsteps behind the hedge. The fisherman, having secured dinner, has come back for dessert. TJ tries to scream and cannot. His throat has shrunk down to a pinhole. Instead of screaming, he whirls himself onto the seat of his bike and begins pedaling. He swerves off the sidewalk and into the street, wanting to get away from the dark bulk of that hedge just as fast as he can. When he leaves the curb, the front tire of his huffy bike squashes through the remains of his Slurpee. As he pedals toward Chase Street, bent over his handlebars like a Grand Prix racer, he leaves a dark and shiny track on the pavement. It looks like blood. Somewhere nearby, a crow caws. It sounds like laughter. 16 Robin Hood Lane. We've been here before, as the chorus girl said to the Archbishop. Peek through the kitchen window and we see Judy Marshall asleep in the rocking chair in the corner. There's a book in her lap, the John Grisham novel we last saw on her bedside table. Sitting beside her on the floor is half a cup of cold coffee. Judy managed to read 10 pages before dozing off. We shouldn't blame Mr. Grisham's narrative skills. Judy had a hard night last night, and it's not the first. It's been over 2 months since she last got more than 2 hours of sleep in one stretch. Fred knows something is wrong with his wife, but has no idea how deep it runs. If he did, he would be a lot more frightened. Soon, God help him, he's going to have a better picture of her mental state. Now she begins to moan thickly and to turn her head from side to side. Those nonsense words begin to issue from her again. Most of them are too sleep fuzzy to understand, but we catch Abala and Gorg. Her eyes suddenly flash open. They are a brilliant royal blue in the morning light, which fills the kitchen with summer's dusty gold. "Ty!" she gasps, and her feet give a convulsive, waking jerk. She looks at the clock over the stove. It is 9:12, and everything seems twisted, as it so often does when we sleep deeply but not well or long. She has sucked some miserable, not-quite-a-nightmare dream after her, like mucusy strings of afterbirth. Men with fedora hats pulled down so as to shadow their faces, walking on long R-crumb legs that ended in big, round-toed R-crumb shoes. Sinister keep-on-truckin' sharpies who move too fast against a city background, Milwaukee, Chicago, and in front of a baleful orange sky. The dream soundtrack was the Benny Goodman Band playing King Porter's Stomp, the one her father had always played when he was getting a little shot, and the feeling of the dream had been a terrible, darkwood mix of terror and grief. Awful things had happened, but the worst was waiting. There's none of the relief people usually feel upon waking from bad dreams, the relief she herself had felt when she had been younger and
sane,
she says in a croaky, just-woke-up voice. King Porter Stomp, think of that. To her, it had always sounded like the music you heard in the old cartoons, the ones where mice in white gloves ran in and out of rat holes with dizzying, feverish speed. Once, when her father was dancing her around to that one, she had felt something hard poking against her, something in his pants. After that, when he put on his dance music, she tried to be somewhere else.
Quit it, she says in the same croaky voice. It's a crow's voice,
and it occurs to her that there was a crow in her dream.
Sure, you bet. The crow Gorg.
Gorg means death, she says, and licks her dry upper lip without realizing it. Her tongue comes out even farther, and on the return swipe, the tip licks across her nostrils, warm and wet and somehow comforting.
Over there, Gorg means death. Over there in the...
Far away is the word she doesn't say. Before she can, she sees something on the kitchen table that wasn't there before. It's a wicker box. A sound is coming from it, some low, sleepy sound. Distress worms into her lower belly, making her bowels feel loose and watery. She knows what a box like that is called, a creel. It's a fisherman's creel. There is a fisherman in French Landing these days. A bad fisherman.
Ty?
She calls, but of course there is no answer. The house is empty except for her. Dale is at work, and Ty will be out playing, you bet. It's half past July, the heart of summer vacation, and Ty will be rolling around the town doing all the Ray Bradbury, August Derleth things boys do when they've got the whole endless summer day to do them in. But he won't be alone. Dale has talked with him about buddying up until the fisherman is caught, at least until then, and so has she. Judy has no great liking for the Wexler kid, the Metzger or Reneker kids either. But there's safety in numbers. Ty probably isn't having any great cultural awakenings this summer, but at least
he's safe,
she says in her croaky, crow-gorg voice. Yet the box that has appeared on the kitchen table during her nap seems to deny that, to negate the whole concept of safety. Where did it come from? And what is the white thing on top of it?
A note, she says,
and gets up. She crosses the short length of floor between the rocker and the table like someone still in a dream. The note is a piece of paper folded over. Written across the half she can see is Sweet Judy Blue Eyes. In college, just before meeting Dale, she had a boyfriend who used to call her that. She asked him to stop. It was annoying, sappy. And when he kept forgetting, on purpose, she suspected, she dropped him like a rock. Now here it is again, that stupid nickname mocking her. Judy turns on the sink tap without taking her eyes from the note, fills her cupped hand with cold water, and drinks. A few drops fall on Sweet Judy Blue Eyes, and the name smears at once. Written in fountain pen ink? How antique. Who writes with a fountain pen these days? She reaches for the note, then draws back. The sound from inside the box is louder now. It's a humming sound.
It's flies,
she says. Her throat has been refreshed by the water, and her voice isn't so croaky, but to herself, Judy still sounds like the crow Gorg.
You know the sound of flies.
Get the note.
Don't want to.
Yes, but you need to. Now get it. What happened to your guts, you little chicken shit?
Good question. Fucking good question.
Judy's tongue comes out, slathers her upper lip and philtrum. Then she takes the note and unfolds it. "Sorry, there is only one kidney. The other I fried and ate. It was very good." The fisherman. The nerves in Judy Marshall's fingers, palms, wrists, and forearms suddenly shut down. The color drops so completely from her face that the blue veins in her cheeks become visible. It's surely a miracle that she doesn't pass out. The note drops from her fingers and goes seesawing to the floor. Shrieking her son's name over and over again, she throws back the lid of the fisherman's creel. Inside are shiny red coils of intestine crawling with flies. There are the wrinkled sacs of lungs and the fist-sized pump that was a child's heart. There is the thick purple pad of a liver and one kidney. This mess of guts is crawling with flies, and all the world is gorg, is gorg, is gorg. In the sunny stillness of her kitchen, Judy Marshall now begins to howl. And it is the sound of madness finally broken free of its flimsy cage. Madness unbound. Butch Yerxa intended to go in after a single smoke. There's always a lot to do on Strawberry Fest days. Although kind-hearted Butch doesn't hate the little artificial holiday the way Pete Wexler does. Then Petra English, an orderly from Asphodel, wandered over and they started talking motorcycles. And before you know it, 20 minutes have passed. He tells Petra he has to go. She tells him to keep the shiny side up and the rubber side down, and Butch slips back in through the door to an unpleasant surprise. There is Charles Burnside, Starkers, standing beside the desk with his hand on the rock Butch uses as a paperweight. His son made it in camp last year, painted the words on it anyway, and Butch thinks it's cute as hell. Butch has nothing against the residents. Certainly he would give Pete Wexler a pasting if he knew about the thing with the cigarettes. Never mind just reporting him. But he doesn't like them touching his things. Especially this guy, who is fairly nasty when he has his few wits about him. Which he does now. Butch can see it in his eyes. The real Charles Burnside has come up for air. Perhaps in honor of Strawberry Fest. And speaking of strawberries, Bernie has apparently been into them already. There are traces of red on his lips and tucked into the deep folds at the corners of his mouth. Butch barely looks at this, though. There are other stains on Bernie, brown ones. "Want to take your hand off that, Charles?" he asks. "Off what?" Bernie asks, then adds, "Ass wipe." Butch doesn't want to say, "off my pet rock." That sounds stupid. "Off my paperweight?" Bernie looks down at the rock, which he has just replaced. There was a little blood and hair on it when he emerged from the toilet stall, but clean up is what bathroom sinks are for. He drops his hand from it and just stands there. "Clean me up, bozo. I shit myself." "So I see. But first tell me if you've gone and spread your crap around the kitchen. And I know you've been down there, so don't lie." "Washed my hands first," Bernie says, and shows them. They are gnarled, but pink and clean for all that. Even the nails are clean. He certainly has washed them. He then adds, "Jack off." "Come on down to the bathroom with me," Butch says. "The jack-off ass wipe will get you cleaned up." Bernie snorts, but comes willingly enough. "You ready for the dance this afternoon?" Butch asks him, just to be saying something. "Got your dancing shoes all polished, big boy?" Bernie, who can surprise you sometimes when he's actually home, smiles, showing a few yellow teeth. Like his lips, they are stained with red. "Yowza, I'm ready to rock," he says. Although Ebby's face doesn't show it, he listens with growing unease to TJ's story about Tyler Marshall's abandoned bike and sneaker. Ronnie's face, on the other hand, shows plenty of unease. "So what are we going to do, Ebby?" TJ asks when he's done. He's finally getting his breath back from his rapid pedal up the hill.
What do you mean, what are we going to do? Ebby says. Same things we were going to do anyway. Go down streets you can find for returnable bottles. Go down to park and trade magics.
But what if shut your yap? Ebby says.
He knows what two words TJ is about to say, and he doesn't want to hear them.
His dad says it's bad luck to toss a hat on the bed, and Ebby never does it. If that's bad luck, mentioning some freako killer's name has got to be twice as bad.
But then that idiot Ronnie Metzger goes and says it anyway, sort of.
But Ebby, what if it's the Mischerfun? What if Ty got grabbed by the shut the fuck up,
Ebby says, and draws back his fist as if to hit the damn mushmouth. At that moment, the raghead clerk pops out of the 7-Eleven like a turbaned jack out of his box.
I am wanting none of that talk here, he cries. You go now, do your fancy talk another place, or I am calling police.
Ebby starts to pedal slowly away, in a direction that will take him farther from Queer Street. Under his breath, he mutters Dune Coon, another charming term he has learned from his father, and the other two boys follow him. When they put a block between them and the 7-Eleven, Ebby stops and faces the other two, both his guts and his jaw jutting.
He rode off on his own half an hour ago, he says.
Huh?
Says TJ.
Who did what?
Says Ronnie.
Ty Marshall. If anyone asks, he rode off on his own half an hour ago, when we were,
Ebby cast his mind back, something that's hard for him because he has had so little practice. In ordinary circumstances, the present is all Ebby Wexler needs.
When we were looking in the window of the All Sorts?
TJ asks timidly, hoping he isn't buying himself one of Ebby's ferocious Indian burns. Ebby looks at him blankly for a moment, then smiles. TJ relaxes. Ronnie Metzger only goes on looking bewildered. With a baseball bat in his hands or a pair of hockey skates on his feet, Ronnie is prince of all he surveys. The rest of the time, he's pretty much at sea.
That's right, Ebby says. Yeah, we was looking in the window of Schmidt's, then that truck came along, the one playing the punk-ass music, and then Ty said he had a split.
Where'd he have to go? TJ asks.
Ebby isn't bright, but he is possessed of what might be termed low cunning. He knows instinctively that the best story is a short story. The less there is, the smaller the chance that someone will trip you up with an inconsistency.
He didn't tell us that. He just said he had to go.
He didn't go anywhere, Ronnie says. He just got behind because he's a...
He pauses, arranging the word, and this time it comes out right.
Slowpoke.
You never mind that, Ebby says.
What if that guy got him, you dummocks? You want people saying it was because he couldn't keep up? That he got killed or something because we left him behind? You want people saying it was our fault?
Gee, Ronnie says. You don't really think the fisherman got Ty, do you?
I don't know and I don't care, Ebby says. But I don't mind it that he's gone. He was starting to piss me off.
Oh.
Ronnie contrives to look both vacant and satisfied.
What a dummox he is, Ebby marvels. What a total and complete dummox.
And if you didn't believe it, just think of how Ronnie, who's as strong as a horse, allows Ebby to give him Indian burn after Indian burn. A day will probably come when Ronnie realizes he doesn't have to put up with that anymore. And on that day, he may well pound Ebby into the ground like a human tent peg. But Ebby doesn't worry about such things. He's even worse at casting his mind forward than he is at casting it back.
Ronnie, Ebby says.
What?
Where were we when Tyler took off?
Schmidt's All Sorts?
Right. And where'd he go?
Didn't say.
Ebby sees that for Ronnie this is already becoming the truth, and is satisfied. He turns to TJ.
You got it?
I got it.
Then let's go.
They pedal off. The dummocks pulls a little ahead of Ebby and TJ as they roll along the tree-lined street, and Ebby allows this. He swings his bike a little closer to TJ's and says,
"You see anything else back there? Anybody, like a guy?"
TJ shakes his head. Just his bike and his sneaker. He pauses, remembering as hard as he can. There were some leaves scattered around from the hedge, and I think there might have been a feather, like a crow feather. Abby dismisses this. He is grappling with the question of whether or not the fisherman has actually come close to him this morning, close enough to snatch one of his buddies. There is a bloodthirsty part of him that likes the idea, that relishes the thought of some shadowy, no-face monster killing the increasingly annoying Time Marshal and eating him for lunch. There is also a childish part of him that is terrified of the boogeyman. This part will be in charge tonight, as he lies awake in his room, looking at shadows that seem to take form and slink ever closer around his bed. And there is the older-than-his-years part of him, which has taken instinctive and immediate measures to avoid the eye of authority should Tyler's disappearance turn into what Ebby's father calls a fuckarow. But mostly, as with Dale Gilbertson and Ty's father Fred, there is a continent of fundamental disbelief inside of Ebby Wexler. He simply cannot believe that anything final has happened to Tyler. Not even after Amy St. Pierre and Johnny Erkenham, who was carved into pieces and hung up in an old henhouse. These are kids of whom Abby has heard on the evening news, fictions from the land of TV. He didn't know Amy or Johnny, so they could have died, just as make-believe people were always dying in the movies and on TV. Ty is different. Ty was just here. He talked to Abby. Abby talked to him. In Abby's mind, this equals immortality. Or should. If Ty could be snatched by the fisherman, any kid could be snatched, including him. Hence, like Dale and Fred, he just doesn't believe it. His most secret and fundamental heart, the part of him that assures the rest of him that everything is fine on planet Ebby, denies the fisherman and all his works. TJ says, "Ebby? Do you think..." "Nah," Ebby says. "He'll turn up. Come on, let's go to the park. We can look for cans and bottles later." Fred Marshall has left his sport coat in his office, rolled up his sleeves, and is helping Rod Tisbury unpack a new Hyler rototiller. It's the first of the new Hyler line, and it's a beaut. "I've been waiting for a gadget like this 20 years or more," Rod says. He expertly inserts the wide end of his crowbar at the top of the big crate, and one of the wooden sides falls to the concrete floor of the maintenance garage with a flat clap. Rod is Goltz's chief mechanic, and out here in maintenance, he is king. "It's gonna work for the small farmer. It's gonna work for the town gardener as well. If you can't sell a dozen of these by fall, you're not doing your job." "I'll sell 20 by the end of August," Fred says with perfect confidence. All his worries have been temporarily swept away by this splendid little green machine, which can do a hell of a lot more than rototill. There are a number of sexy attachments that snap in and out as easily as the lining in a fall jacket. He wants to start it up, listen to it run. That two-cylinder engine looks pretty sweet. "Fred?" He looks around impatiently. It's Ina Gateskill, Ted Goltz's secretary and the dealership receptionist. "What?" "You've got a call on line one." She points across the floor, alive with clanging machinery and the noisy whir of pneumatic screwdrivers loosening bolts on an old case tractor, to the phone on the wall where several lights are blinking. "Can you take a message, Ina? I was going to help Rod get a battery in this little beast, and then I think you should take the call. It's a woman named Enid Purvis, a neighbor of yours?" For a moment, Fred blanks, and then his salesman's mind, which stores up names compulsively, comes to his rescue. Enid Purvis, wife of Deke, corner of Robin Hood and Maid Marian. He saw Deke just this morning. They waved to each other. At the same time, he becomes aware that Ina's eyes are too big, and her normally generous mouth is too small. She looks worried. "What is it?" Fred asks. "Ina, what is it?"
"I don't know."
Then, reluctantly,
"Something about your wife."
"Better take it, Haas," Rod says, but Fred is already crossing the oil-stained concrete floor to the phone.
He arrives home 10 minutes after leaving Goltz's, peeling out of the employee's parking lot and laying rubber like a teenager. The worst part had been Enid Purvis's calm and careful delivery. How hard she'd been trying not to sound frightened. She had been walking Potsy past the Marshall house, she said, when she heard Judy scream. Not once, but twice. Of course, Enid had done what any good neighbor would, God bless her, gone up to the door, rapped, then pushed open the letter slot and called through it. If there had been no answer, she told Fred, she probably would have phoned the police. She wouldn't even have gone back home to do it. She would have crossed the street to the Plotsky's house and called from there. But, "I'm all right," Judy had called back, and then she had laughed. The laugh was shrill, ending in a tittery gasp. Enid had found this laugh somehow even more upsetting than the screams. "It was all a dream. Even Ty was a dream." "Did you cut yourself, dear?" Enid had called through the letter slot. "Did you fall down?" "There was no creel," Judy had called back. She might have said keel, but Enid was quite sure it was creel. "I dreamed that, too." Then, Enid reluctantly told Fred, Judy Marshall had begun crying. It had been very upsetting, listening to that sound come to her through the letter slot. It had even made the dog whine. Enid had called through one more time, asking if she could come in and make sure Judy wasn't hurt. "Go away," Judy had called back. In the midst of her crying, she'd laughed again, an angry, distracted laugh. "You're a dream, too. This whole world is a dream." Then there had been the sound of shattering glass, as if she had struck a coffee mug or water tumbler and knocked it to the floor, or thrown it at the wall. "I didn't call the police because she sounded all right," Enid told Fred. Fred standing with the phone jammed up against one ear and his hand plastered over the other to cut out all the yammering mechanical sounds, which he ordinarily enjoys, and which at that moment seemed to go into his head like chrome spikes. "Physically, all right, anyway, but Fred, I think you ought to go home and check on her." All of Judy's recent oddities went through his mind in a whirl. So did Pat Scarta's words. Mental dysfunction. We hear people say so-and-so snapped, but there are usually signs. And he has seen the signs, hasn't he? Seen them and done nothing. Fred parks his car, a sensible Ford Explorer, in the driveway, and hurries up the steps, already calling his wife's name. There is no answer. Even when he has stepped through the front door, he pushes it open so hard the brass letter slot gives a nonsensical little clack. There is no answer. The air-conditioned interior of the house feels too cold on his skin, and he realizes he's sweating. "Judy? Jude?" Still no answer. He hurries down the hall to the kitchen, where he is most apt to find her if he comes home for something in the middle of the day. The kitchen is sun-washed and empty. The table and the counter are clean. The appliances gleam. Two coffee cups have been placed in the dish drainer, winking sun from their freshly washed surfaces. More sun winks from a heap of broken glass in the corner. Fred sees a flower decal on one piece and realizes it was the vase on the windowsill. "Judy?" he calls again. He can feel the blood hammering in his throat and at his temples. She doesn't answer him, but he hears her upstairs, beginning to sing. "I'd like to thank the guy who wrote the song that made my baby fall in love with me." Fred recognizes it, and instead of feeling relieved at the sound of her voice, his flesh goes even colder. It's a nonsense rock and roll song called "Who Put the Bump?" She used to sing it to Tyler when their son was little. "Ty's Lullaby," she called it. Fred hasn't heard that particular ditty come out of her mouth in years. He goes back down the hall to the stairs, now seeing what he missed on his first trip. The Andrew Wyeth print, Christina's World, has been taken down and set against the baseboard heater. The wallpaper below the picture hook has been scraped away in several places, revealing the plasterboard beneath. Fred, colder than ever, knows that Judy did this. It isn't intuition, exactly, not deduction, either. Call it the telepathy of the long married. Floating down from above, beautiful and on key, yet at the same time perfectly empty, who put the bomp and the bomp-a-bomp-a-bomp? Who put the ram and the ram-a-lam-a-ding-dong? Who put the dip and the dip-da-dip-da-dip? Who put the shoe in the boogity-boogity-shoe? Fred is up the stairs, two at a time, calling her name. The upper hall is a scary mess. This is where they have hung the gallery of their past. Fred and Judy outside Madison's Shoes, a blues club they sometimes went to when there was nothing interesting going on at the Chocolate Watch Band. Fred and Judy dancing the first dance at their wedding reception while their folks happily looked on. Judy in a hospital bed, exhausted but smiling, holding the wrapped bundle that was Ty. The photo of the Marshall family farm that she always sniffed at, more. Most of these framed photographs have been taken down. Some, like the one of the farm, have been thrown down. Glass litters the hall in sparkling sprays, and she has been at the wallpaper behind half a dozen. In the spot where the picture of Judy and Ty in the hospital had hung, the paper has been torn almost completely away, and he can see where she scraped at the wallboard beneath. Some of the scratches are dappled with drying spots of blood. Judy! Judy! Tyler's door stands open. Fred sprints the length of the upstairs hall with glass crunching under his loafers. Who was that man? I'd like to shake his hand. He made my baby fall in love with me. Judy! He stands in the door, all words temporarily knocked out of him. Ty's room looks like the aftermath of a rough search in a detective movie. The drawers have been yanked out of his bureau and lie everywhere, most overturned. The bureau itself has been pulled away from the wall. Summer clothes are spread hell to breakfast, jeans and t-shirts and underwear and white athletic socks. The closet door is open, and more clothes have been struck from the hangers. That same spousal telepathy tells them she tore Ty's slacks and button-up shirts down so she could make sure nothing was behind them. The coat of Tyler's only suit hangs askew from the closet's doorknob. His posters have been pulled from the walls. Mark McGuire has been torn in half. In every case but one, she has left the wallpaper behind the posters alone. But the one exception is a beaut. Behind the rectangle where the poster of the castle hung, come back to the old sod, the wallpaper has been almost entirely stripped away. There are more streaks of blood on the wallboard beneath. Judy Marshall sits on the bare mattress of her son's bed. The sheets are heaped in the corner along with the pillow. The bed itself has been yanked away from the wall. Judy's head is down. He can't see her face. Her hair is screening it. But she's wearing shorts, and he can see dapples and streaks of blood on her tanned thighs. Her hands are clasped below her knees, out of sight, and Fred is glad. He doesn't want to see how badly she has hurt herself until he has to. His heart is hammering in his chest, his nervous system is redlining with adrenaline overload, and his mouth tastes like a burnt fuse. She begins to sing the chorus of Ty's lullaby again, and he can't stand it. Judy, no, he says, going to her through the strewn minefield that was only last night when he came in to give Ty a goodnight kiss, a reasonably neat little boy's room. Stop, honey. It's okay. For a wonder, she does stop. She raises her head, and when he sees the terrified look in her eyes, he loses what little breath he has left. It's more than terror. It's emptiness, as if something inside her has slipped aside and exposed a black hole. Ty's gone, she says simply. I looked behind all the pictures I could. I was sure he'd be behind that one. If he was anywhere, he'd be behind that one. She points toward the place where the Ireland travel poster hung, and he sees that four of the nails on her left hand have been ripped partly or completely away. His stomach does a flip-flop. Her fingers look as if they have been dipped in red ink. If only it was ink, Fred thinks, if only.
But of course, it's just a picture. They're all just pictures, I see that now.
She pauses, then cries, Abala! Munchan! Abala Gorg! Abala Doon! Her tongue comes out to an impossible cartoonish length, and swipes spittishly across her nose. Fred sees it but cannot believe it. This is like coming into a horror movie halfway through the show, discovering it's real and not knowing what to do. What is he supposed to do? When you discover that the woman you love has gone mad, had a break with reality at the very least, what are you supposed to do? How the hell do you deal with it?
But he loves her. Has loved her from the first week he knew her, helplessly and completely and without the slightest regret ever after, and now love guides him. He sits down next to her on the bed, puts his arm around her, and simply holds her. He can feel her trembling from the inside out. Her body thrums like a wire.
I love you, he says, surprised at his voice. It's amazing that seeming calmness can issue from such a crazy cauldron of confusion and fear. I love you, and everything is going to be all right. She looks up at him, and something comes back into her eyes. Fred cannot call it sanity, no matter how much he would like to, but it is at least some sort of marginal awareness. She knows where she is and who is with her. For a moment he sees gratitude in her eyes. Then her face cramps in a fresh agony of grief, and she begins to weep. It is an exhausted, lost sound that wrenches at him. Nerves, heart, and mind. It wrenches at him.
Ty's gone, Judy says. Gorg fascinated him, and the Abala took him. Abala Doon.
The tears course down her cheeks. When she raises her hands to wipe them away, her fingers leave appalling streaks of blood. Even though he's sure Tyler is fine, certainly Fred has had no premonitions today, unless we count his rosy sales prediction about the new Hyla Roto, he feels a shudder course through him at the sight of those streaks, and it is not Judy's condition that causes it, but what she's just said. Ty's gone. Ty is with his friends. He told Fred just last night that he, Ronnie, TJ, and the less-than-pleasant Wexler boy intended to spend the day goofing off. If the other three boys go somewhere Ty doesn't want to be, he has promised to come directly home. All the bases seem to be covered, yet is there not such a thing as mother's intuition? Well, he thinks maybe on the Fox network. He picks Judy up in his arms and is appalled all over again, this time by how light she is. She's lost maybe 20 pounds since the last time I picked her up like this, he thinks. At least 10. How could I not have noticed? But he knows. Preoccupation with work was part of it. A stubborn refusal to let go of the idea that things were basically all right was the rest of it. Well, he thinks, carrying her out the door, her arms have crept tiredly up and locked themselves around his neck, I'm over that little misconception. And he actually believes this, in spite of his continued blind confidence in his son's safety. Judy hasn't toured their bedroom during her rampage, and to Fred it looks like a cool oasis of sanity. Judy apparently feels the same way. She gives a tired sigh, and her arms drop away from her husband's neck. Her tongue comes out, but this time it gives only a feeble little lick at her upper lip. Fred bends and puts her down on the bed. She holds up her hands, looks at them.
I cut myself, scraped myself.
Yes, he says. I'm going to get something for them.
How?
He sits beside her for a moment. Her head has sunk into the soft, double thickness of her pillows, and her eyelids are drooping. He thinks that beyond the puzzlement in them, he can still see that terrifying blankness. He hopes he is wrong. Don't you remember? he asks her gently.
No. Did I fall down?
Fred chooses not to answer. He is starting to think again. Not much, he's not capable of much just yet, but a little. Honey, what's a gorg? What's an abala? Is it a person?
Don't... no. Ty...
Ty's fine, he says.
No.
Yes, he insists. Perhaps he's insisting to both of the people in this pretty, tastefully decorated bedroom. Honey Bunch, you just lie there. I want to get a couple of things. Her eyes drift closed. He thinks she will sleep, but her lids struggle slowly back up to half-mast. Lie right there, he says. No getting up and wandering around. There's been enough of that. You scared poor Enid Purvis out of a year's life. You promise?
Promise.
Her eyelids drift back down. Fred goes into the adjoining bathroom, ears alert for any movement behind him. He has never seen anyone in his life who looks more bolt-shot than Judy does right now. But mad people are clever, and despite his prodigious capacity for denial in some areas, Fred can no longer fool himself about his wife's current mental state. Mad? Actually stark, raving mad? Probably not. But off the rails, certainly. Temporarily off the rails, he amends, as he opens the medicine cabinet. He takes the bottle of mercurochrome, then scans the prescription bottles on the shelf above. There aren't many. He grabs the one on the far left. Sonata, French Landing Pharmacy. One capsule at bedtime. Do not use more than 4 nights in a row. Prescribing physician Patrick J. Scarda, M.D. Fred can't see the entire bed in the medicine cabinet mirror, but he can see the foot of it and one of Judy's feet as well, still on the bed. Good. Good. He shakes out one of the sonatas, then dumps their toothbrushes out of the glass. He has no intention of going all the way downstairs for a clean glass, does not want to leave her alone that long. He fills the glass, then goes back into the bedroom with the water, the pill, and the bottle of mercurochrome. Her eyes are shut. She is breathing so slowly that he has to put one hand on her chest to make sure she's breathing at all. He looks at the sleeping pill, debates, then gives her a shake. Judy? Jude? Wake up a little, hon, just long enough to take a pill, okay? She doesn't even mutter, and Fred sets the sonata aside. It won't be necessary after all. He feels some faint optimism at how fast she's fallen asleep and how deep she has gone. It's as if some vile sack has popped, discharged its poison, left her weak and tired, but possibly okay again. Could that be? Fred doesn't know, but he's positive that she isn't just shamming sleep. All of Judy's current woes began with insomnia, and the insomnia has been the one constant throughout. Although she's only been exhibiting distressing symptoms for a couple of months, talking to herself and doing that odd and rather disgusting thing with her tongue, to mention only a couple of items, she hasn't been sleeping well since January. Hence the sonata. Now it seems that she has finally tipped over. And is it too much to hope that when she wakes from a normal sleep, she'll be her old normal self again? That her worries about her son's safety during the summer of the fisherman have forced her to some sort of climax? Maybe, maybe not. But at least it has given Fred some time to think about what he should do next. And he had better use it well. One thing seems to him beyond argument. If Ty is here when his mother wakes up, Ty is going to have a much happier mother. The immediate question is how to locate Tyler as soon as possible. His first thought is to call the homes of Ty's friends. It would be easy. Those numbers are posted on the fridge, printed in Judy's neat, back-slanting hand, along with the numbers of the fire department, the police department, including Dale Gilbertson's private number, he's an old friend, and French Landing Rescue. But it takes Fred only a moment to realize what a bad idea this is. Abby's mother is dead, and his father is an unpleasant moron. Fred met him just once, and once is more than enough. Fred doesn't much like his wife labeling some people low raiders. Who do you think you are? He asked her once. Queen of the doggone realm. But in the case of Pete Wexler, the shoe fits. He won't have any idea of where the boys are today and won't care. Mrs. Metzger and Ellen Reniker might, but having once been a boy on summer vacation himself, the whole world laid at your feet and at least 2,000 places to go, Fred doubts it like hell. There's a chance the boys might be eating lunch, it's getting to be that time, at the Metzger's or Reniker's. But is that slight chance worth scaring the hell out of two women? Because the killer will be the first thing they think of, just as sure as God made little fishes. And fishermen to catch him. Once more sitting on the bed beside his wife, Fred feels his first real tingle of apprehension on his son's behalf, and dismisses it brusquely. This is no time to give in to the heebie-jeebies. He has to remember that his wife's mental problems and his son's safety are not linked, except in her mind. His job is to present Ty front and center and all squared away, thus proving her fears groundless. Fred looks at the clock on his side of the bed and sees that it's 11:15. How the time flies when you're having fun, he thinks. Beside him, Judy utters a single, gaspy snore. It's a small sound, really quite ladylike, but Fred jumps anyway. How she scared him when he first saw her in Ty's room. He's still scared. Ty and his friends may come here for lunch. Judy says they often do because the Metzgers don't have much to eat, and Mrs. Reniker usually serves what the boys call goop, a mystery dish consisting of noodles and some gray meat. Judy makes them Campbell's soup and bologna sandwiches, stuff they like. But Ty has money enough to treat them all to McDonald's up by the little mall on the north side, or they could go into Sonny's Cruise and Restaurant, a cheap diner with a cheesy 50s ambiance. And Ty isn't adverse to treating. He's a generous boy. I'll wait until lunch, he murmurs, completely unaware that he is talking as well as thinking. Certainly he doesn't disturb Judy. She has gone deep. Then what? He doesn't know exactly. He goes downstairs, kicks the Mr. Coffee back into gear, and calls work. He asks Ina to tell Ted Goltz he'll be out the rest of the day. Judy's sick. The flu, he tells her. Throwing up and everything. He runs down a list of people he was expecting to see that day and tells her to speak to Otto Eisman about handling them. Otto will be on that like white on rice. An idea occurs to him while he's talking to her, and when he's done, he calls the Metzgers and Renikers after all. At the Metzgers, he gets an answering machine and hangs up without leaving a message. Ellen Reniker, however, picks up on the second ring. Sounding casual and cheerful, it comes naturally, he's a hell of a salesman, he asks her to have Ty call home if the boys show up there for lunch. Fred says he has something to tell his son, making it sound like something good. Ellen says she will, but adds that TJ had $4 or $5 burning a hole in his jeans when he left the house that morning, and she doesn't expect to see him until supper time. Fred goes back upstairs and checks on Judy. She hasn't moved so much as a finger, and he supposes that's good. No, there's nothing good about any of this. Instead of receding, now that the situation has stabilized, sort of, his fear seems to be intensifying. Telling himself that Ty is with his friends no longer seems to help. The sunny, silent house is creeping him out. He realizes he no longer wants Ty front and center simply for his wife's sake. Where would the boys go? Is there any one place? Of course there is. Where they can get magic cards, that stupid, incomprehensible game they play. Fred Marshall hurries back downstairs, grabs the phone book, hunts through the yellow pages, and calls the 7-Eleven. Like most of French Landing, Fred is in the 7-Eleven 4 or 5 times a week, a can of soda here, a carton of orange juice there, and he recognizes the lilt of the Indian day clerk's voice. He comes up with the man's name at once, Rajan Patel. It's that old salesman's trick of keeping as many names as possible in the active file. It sure helps here. When Fred calls the man Mr. Patel, the day clerk immediately becomes friendly, perfectly willing to help. Unfortunately, there isn't much help he can give. Lots of boys in. They are buying magic cards, also Pokemon and baseball cards. Some are trading these cards outside. He does recall three that came in that morning on bikes, he says. They bought Slurpees as well as cards and then argued about something outside. Rajan Patel doesn't mention the cursing, although this is chiefly why he remembers these boys. After a little while, he says they went on their way. Fred is drinking coffee without even remembering when he poured it. Fresh threads of unease are spinning spider silky webs in his head. Three boys. Three. It means nothing, you know that, don't you? He tells himself. He does know it. And at the same time, he doesn't know it. He can't even believe he's caught a little of Judy's freakiness, like a cold germ. This is just, well, freakiness for freakiness's sake. He asks Patel to describe the kids and isn't too surprised when Patel can't. He thinks one of them was a bit of a fat boy, but he's not even sure of that.
Sorry, but I am seeing so many, he says.
Fred tells him he understands. He does, too, only all the understanding in the world won't ease his mind. Three boys. Not four, but three. Lunchtime has come, but Fred is not the least bit hungry. The spooky, sunny silence maintains itself. The spider webs continue to spin. Not four, but three. If it was Ty's bunch that Mr. Patel saw, the fattish boy was certainly Abby Wexler. The question is, who are the other two? And which one was missing? Which one had been stupid enough to go off on his own? Ty's gone. Gorg fascinated him and the Abalot took him. Crazy talk, no doubt about it. But Fred's arms nevertheless break out in a lush of goosebumps. He puts his coffee mug down with a bang. He'll clean up the broken glass, that's what he'll do. That's the next step, no doubt about it. The actual next step, the logical next step, whispers through his mind as he climbs the stairs, and he immediately pushes it away. He's sure the cops are just lately overwhelmed with queries from hysterical parents who have lost track of their kids for an hour or so. The last time he saw Dale Gilbertson, the poor guy looked careworn and grim. Fred doesn't want to be marked down as part of the problem instead of part of the solution. Still, not four, but three. He gets the dustpan and broom out of the little utility closet next to the laundry room and begins sweeping up broken glass. When he's done, he checks on Judy, sees she's still sleeping, more deeply than ever from the look of her, and goes down to Ty's room. If Ty saw it like this, he'd be upset. He'd think his mom was a lot more than a Coke short of a Happy Meal. You don't have to worry about that, his mind whispers. He won't be seeing his room, not tonight, not ever. Gorg fascinated him and the Abalot took him. Stop it, Fred tells himself. Stop being an old woman. But the house is too empty, too silent, and Fred Marshall is afraid. Setting Tyler's room to rights takes longer than Fred ever would have expected. His wife went through it like a whirlwind. How can such a little woman have such strength in her? Is it the strength of the mad? Perhaps, but Judy doesn't need the strength of the mad. When she sets her mind to something, she is a formidable engine. By the time he's finished cleaning up, almost 2 hours have passed, and the only obvious scar is the scratched-out rectangle of wallpaper where the Irish travel poster hung. Sitting on Ty's remade bed, Fred finds that the longer he looks at that spot, the less he can stand the white wallboard peering through as brazenly as a broken bone through outraged skin. He has washed away the streaks of blood, but can do nothing about the scratch mark she made with her nails. Yes, I can, he thinks. Yes, I can, too. Ty's dresser is mahogany, a piece of furniture that came to them from the estate of some distant relative on Judy's side. Moving it really isn't a one-man job, and under the circumstances, that suits Fred just fine. He slides a rug remnant under it to keep from marking up the floor, then slides it across the room. Once it's been placed against the far wall, it covers most of the scratched area. With the bald spot out of sight, Fred feels better. Saner. Ty hasn't come home for lunch, but Fred didn't really expect he would. He'll be home by 4 at the latest, home for supper. Take it to the bank.
Fred strolls back to the master bedroom, massaging the small of his back as he walks. Judy still hasn't moved, and once again he puts an anxious hand on her chest. Her breathing is slow but steady as she goes. That's all right. He lies down beside her on the bed, goes to loosen his tie, and laughs when he feels his open collar. Coat and tie, both back at Gulse's. Well, it's been a crazy day. For the time being, it's just good to lie here in the air-conditioned cool, easing his aching back. Moving that dresser was a bitch, but he's glad he did it. Certainly there's no chance he'll drop off. He's far too upset. Besides, napping in the middle of the day has never been his thing. So thinking, Fred falls asleep. Beside him, in her own sleep, Judy begins to whisper, Gorg, Abala, the Crimson King, and a woman's name. The name is Sophie. Chapter 6. In the ready room of the French Landing PD, the phone on the desk rings. Bobby Dulac has been mining for nose gold. Now he squashes his latest treasure on the sole of his shoe and picks up the phone.
Yellow, Police Department, Officer Dulac speaking. How can I help you?
Hey, Bobby, it's Danny Cheetah.
Bobby feels a prick of unease. Danny Cheetah, last name pronounced Cheetah, is one of French Landing's 14 full-time RMP cops. He's currently on duty, and ordinary procedure dictates that duty cops radio in. That's what the R in RMP stands for, after all. The only exception to the rule has to do with the fishermen. Dale has mandated that patrol officers call in on a landline if they think they have a situation involving the killer. Too many people have their ears on out there, doubtless including Wendell Pisshead Green.
Danny, what's up?
Maybe nothing. Maybe something not so good. I got a bike and a sneaker in the trunk of my car. I found them over on Queen Street near Maxton Eldercare.
Bobby draws a pad toward him and begins to jot. The tickle of unease has become a sinking feeling.
Nothing wrong with the bike, Danny continues. Just sitting there on its kickstand, but combined with the sneaker...
Yeah, I see your point, Danny, but you never should have fooled with what could be evidence of a crime.
Please, God, don't let it be evidence of a crime, Bobby Dulac is thinking. Please, God, don't let it be another one.
Irma Freneau's mother has just been in to see Dale, and while there was no screaming or shouting, she came out with tears on her cheeks and looking like death on the half shell. They can't still be sure the little girl has become the fisherman's third victim, but Bobby, I had to, Danny is saying. I'm riding solo. I didn't want to put this on the air. I had to find a phone. If I'd left the bike there, someone else could have monkeyed with it. Hell, stolen it. This is a good bike, Schwinn 3-speed. Better than the one my kids got, tell you that.
What's your 20?
7-Eleven up the hill on 35?
What I did was mark the location of the bike and the sneaker with chalk X's on the sidewalk. I handled them with gloves and put the sneaker in an evidence bag.
Danny is sounding more and more anxious. Bobby knows how he must feel, sympathizes with the choices Danny had to make. Riding solo is a bitch, but French Landing is already supporting as many cops, full-time and part-time, as the budget will bear. Unless, of course, this fisherman business gets totally out of control. In that case, the town fathers will no doubt discover a bit more elastic in the budget.
Maybe it's already out of control, Bobby thinks.
Okay, Danny, okay, see your point.
Whether or not Dale sees it is a whole nother thing, Bobby thinks.
Danny lowers his voice.
No one needs to know I broke the chain of evidence, do they? I mean, if the subject ever came up, in court or something.
I guess that's up to Dale.
Oh, God. Bobby thinks. A new problem has just occurred to him. All calls that come in on this phone are automatically taped. Bobby decides the taping machinery is about to have a malfunction, retroactive to about 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
And you want to know the other thing? Danny is asking. The big thing?
I didn't want people to see it. A bike standing all by itself that way, you don't have to be Sherlock fucking Holmes to draw a certain conclusion.
and folks are getting close to the panic line, especially after that goddamned irresponsible story in the paper this morning. I didn't want to call from Maxton's for the same reason. I'm going to put you on hold. You better talk to Dale.
In a vastly unhappy voice, Danny says,
"Oh, boy."
In Dale Gilbertson's office, there is a bulletin board dominated by enlarged photographs of Amy St. Pierre and Johnny Erkenham. A third photo will be added soon, he fears, that of Irma Freneau. Beneath the two current photos, Dale sits at his desk, smoking a Marlboro 100. He's got the fan on. It will, he hopes, blow the smoke away. Sarah would just about kill him if she knew he was smoking again, but dear Jesus Christ, he needs something. His interview with Tansy Freneau had been short and nothing short of purgatorial. Tansy is a juicer, a regular patron of the Sand Bar, and during their interview the smell of coffee brandy was so strong it almost seemed to be coming out of her pores, another excuse for the fan. Half drunk she had been, and Dale was glad. It kept her calm, at least. It didn't put any sparkle in her dead eyes. Coffee brandy was no good for that, but she had been calm. Hideously, she had even said, "Thank you for helping me, sir," before leaving. Tansy's ex, Irma's father, lives across the state in Green Bay. "Green Bay is the devil's town," Dale's father used to say, God knows why, where he works in a garage and, according to Tansy, supports several bars with names like the End Zone and the 50-yard line. Until today, there has been some reason to believe, at least to hope, that Richard Cubby Freneau snatched his daughter. An email from the Green Bay Police Department has put paid to that little idea. Cubby Freneau is living with a woman who has two kids of her own, and he was in jail, D&D, the day Irma disappeared. There is still no body, and Tansy hasn't received a letter from the fisherman, but the door opens. Bobby Dulac sticks his head in. Dale mashes his cigarette out on the inside lip of the wastebasket, burning the back of his hand with sparks in the process.
"Gosh and fishes, Bobby, do you know how to knock?"
"Sorry, Chief." Bobby looks at the smoke, ribboning up from the wastebasket with neither surprise nor interest.
"Danny Cheetah's on the phone. I think you better take it."
"What's it about?" But he knows. Why else would it be the phone? Bobby only repeats, not without sympathy, "I think you better take it." The car sent by Rebecca Vilas delivers Henry to Maxton Elder Care at 3:30, 90 minutes before the Strawberry Fest dance is scheduled to begin. The idea is for the old folks to work up an appetite on the floor, then troop down to the caff, suitably decorated for the occasion, for a glamorously late, 7:30 is quite late for Maxton's, dinner, with wine for those who drink it. A resentful Pete Wexler has been drafted by Rebecca Vilas to bring in the DJ's shit. Pete thinks of Henry as the blind record hopper. Said shit consists of two speakers, very large, one turntable, light but awkward as a motherfucker to carry, one preamp, very heavy, assorted wires, all tangled up, but that's the blind record hopper's problem, and four boxes of actual records, which went out of style about 100 years ago. Pete guesses that the blind record hopper never heard a CD in his whole life. The last item is a suit bag on a hanger. Pete has peeked in and ascertained that the suit is white. "Hang it in there, please," Henry says, pointing with unerring accuracy toward the supply closet, which has been designated his dressing room.
"Okay," Pete says. "What exactly is it, if you don't mind me asking?"
Henry smiles. He knows perfectly well that Pete has already had a peep. He heard the plastic bag rattling and the zipper chinking in a duet that only occurs when someone pulls the bag away from the hanger at the neck. Inside that bag, my friend, Symphonic Stan, the big band man, is just waiting for me to put him on and bring him to life.
"Oh, uh-huh," Pete says, not knowing if he has been answered or not. All he's really sure of is that those records were almost as heavy as the preamp. Someone should really give the blind record hopper some information about CDs, the next great leap forward.
"You asked me one. May I ask you one? Be my guest," Pete says. There appears to have been a police presence at Maxton Elder Care this afternoon, the blind record hopper says. They're gone now, but they were here when I arrived. What's that about? There hasn't been a robbery or an assault among the geriatrics, I hope.
Pete stops in his tracks beneath a large cardboard strawberry, holding the suit bag and looking at the blind record hopper with an amazement Henry can almost touch.
How'd you know the cops were here?
Henry puts a finger to the side of his nose and tips his head to one side. He replies in a hoarse, conspiratorial whisper, "Smelled something blue."
Pete looks puzzled, debates whether or not to inquire further, and decides not to. Resuming his march toward the supply closet dressing room, he says, "They're playing it cagey, but I think they're looking for another lost kid."
The look of amused curiosity fades from Henry's face.
"Good Christ," he says. "They came and went in a hurry. No kids here, Mr. Layden?"
"Layden," Henry confirms.
"A kid in this place would stand out like a rose in a patch of poison ivy, if you know what I mean."
Henry doesn't consider old folks in any way analogous to poison ivy, but he does indeed get Mr. Wexler's drift.
"What made them think someone found something on the sidewalk?" Pete says.
He points out the window, then realizes the blind guy can't see him pointing. "Duh," as Ebby would say. He lowers his hand.
"If a kid got snatched, someone probably came along in a car and snatched him. No kidnappers in here, I can tell you that much."
Pete laughs at the very idea of a Maxton moldy oldie snatching any kid big enough to ride a bike. The kid would probably break the guy over his knee like a dry stick.
"No," Henry says soberly. "That hardly seems likely, does it?
But I guess the cops gotta dot all the T's and cross all the I's."
He pauses. "That's just a little joke of mine."
Henry smiles politely, thinking that with some people, Alzheimer's disease might be an actual improvement.
"When you hang my suit up, Mr. Wexler, would you be so good as to give it a gentle shake, just to banish any incipient wrinkles?"
"Okay. Want me to take it out of the bag for you?"
"Thanks, that won't be necessary."
Pete goes into the supply closet, hangs up the suit bag, and gives it a little shake.
Incipient. Just what the hell does that mean? There's a rudiment of a library here at Maxton's. Maybe he'll look it up in the dictionary. It pays to increase your word power, as it says in the Reader's Digest, although Pete doubts it will pay him much in this job. When he goes back out to the common room, the blind record hopper, Mr. Layden, Symphonic Stan, whoever the hell he is, has begun unraveling wires and plugging them in with a speed and accuracy Pete finds a trifle unnerving. Poor old Fred Marshall is having a terrible dream. Knowing it's a dream should make it less horrible, but somehow doesn't. He's in a rowboat with Judy out on a lake. Judy is sitting in the bow. They are fishing. He is, at least. Judy is just holding her pole. Her face is an expressionless blank. Her skin is waxy. Her eyes have a stunned, hammered look. He labors with increasing desperation to make contact with her, trying one conversational gambit after another. None work. To make what is, under the circumstances, a fairly apt metaphor, she spits every lure. He sees that her empty eyes appear fixed on the creel sitting between them in the bottom of the boat. Blood is oozing through the wickerwork in fat, red dribbles. "It's nothing, just fish blood," he tries to assure her, but she makes no reply. In fact, Fred isn't so sure himself. He's thinking he ought to take a look inside the creel just to be sure, when his pole gives a tremendous jerk. If not for quick reflexes, he would have lost it over the side. He's hooked a big one. Fred reels it in, the fish on the other end of the line fighting him for every foot. Then, when he finally gets it near the boat, he realizes he has no net. Hell with it, he thinks. Go for broke. He whips the pole backward, just daring the line to snap, and the fish, biggest goddamned lake trout you'd ever hope to see, flies out of the water and through the air in a gleaming, fin-flipping arc. It lands in the bottom of the boat, beside the oozing creel, in fact, and begins thrashing. It also begins to make gruesome choking noises. Fred has never heard a fish make noises like that. He bends forward and is horrified to see that the trout has Tyler's face. His son has somehow become a were-trout, and now he's dying in the bottom of the boat, strangling. Fred grabs at it, wanting to remove the hook and throw it back while there's still time, but the terrible, choking thing keeps slipping through his fingers, leaving only a shiny slime of scales behind. It would be tough to get the hook out in any case. The Thai fish has swallowed it whole, and the barbed tip is actually protruding from one of the gills, just below the point where the human face melts away. Thai's choking becomes louder, harsher, infinitely more horrible. Fred sits up, with a low cry, feeling as if he's choking himself. For a moment he's completely adrift as to place and time. Lost in the slippage, we might say. And then he realizes he's in his own bedroom, sitting up on his side of the bed he shares with Judy. He notices that the light in here is much dimmer, because the sun has moved to the other side of the house. My God, he thinks. How long have I been asleep? How could I... Oh, but here is another thing. That hideous choking sound has followed him out of his dream. It's louder than ever. It will wake Judy, scare her... Judy is no longer on the bed, though. Jude? Judy? She's sitting in the corner. Her eyes are wide and blank, just as they were in his dream. A corsage of crumpled paper is protruding from her mouth. Her throat is grotesquely swelled, looks to Fred like a sausage that has been grilled until the casing is ready to pop. More paper, he thinks. Christ, she's choking on it. Fred rolls himself across the bed, falls off, and lands on his knees like a gymnast doing a trick. He reaches for her. She makes no move to evade him. There's that at least. And although she's choking, he still sees no expression in her eyes. They are dusty zeros. Fred yanks the corsage of paper from her mouth. There's another behind it. Fred reaches between her teeth, tweezes this second ball of paper between the first two fingers of his right hand, thinking, please don't bite me, Judy, please don't, and pulls it out too. There's a third ball of paper behind this one, way at the back of her mouth. He gets hold of this one as well and extracts it. Although it's crumpled, he can see the printed words, great idea, and knows what she's swallowed, sheets of paper from the notepad Ty gave her for her birthday. She's still choking. Her skin is turning slate. Fred grabs her by her upper arms and pulls her up. She comes easily, but when he relaxes his hold, her knees bend, and she starts to go back down. She's turned into Raggedy Ann. The choking sound continues. Her sausage throat, help me, Judy! Help me, you bitch! Unaware of what he is saying. He yanks her hard as he yanked the fishing pole in his dream, and spins her around like a ballerina when she comes up on her toes. Then he seizes her in a bear hug, his wrists brushing the undersides of her breasts, her bottom tight against his crotch, the kind of position he would find extremely sexy if his wife didn't happen to be choking to death. He pops his thumb up between her breasts like a hitchhiker, then says the magic word as he pulls sharply upward and backward. The magic word is Heimlich, and it works. Two more wads of paper fly from Judy's mouth, propelled by a jet of vomit that is little more than bile. Her intake of food over the last 12 hours amounts to 3 cups of coffee and a cranberry muffin. She gives a gasp, coughs twice, then begins to breathe more or less normally. He puts her on the bed, drops her on the bed. His lower back is spasming wildly, and it's really no wonder. First Ty's dresser, now this. Well, what did you think you were doing? He asks her loudly. What in the name of Christ did you think you were doing? He realizes that he has raised one hand over Judy's upturned face as if to strike her. Part of him wants to strike her. He loves her, but at this moment he also hates her. He has imagined plenty of bad things over the years they've been married. Judy getting cancer, Judy paralyzed in an accident, Judy first taking a lover and then demanding a divorce. But he's never imagined Judy going chicken shit on him. And isn't that what this amounts to? What did you think you were doing? She looks at him without fear, but without anything else either. Her eyes are dead. Her husband lowers his hand, thinking, I'd cut it off before I hit you. I might be pissed at you, I am pissed at you, but I'd cut it off before I did that. Judy rolls over, face down on the coverlet, her hair spread around her head in a corona. Judy? Nothing. She just lies there. Fred looks at her for a moment, then uncrumples one of the slimy balls of paper with which she has tried to strangle herself. It is covered with tangles of scribbled words. Gorg, Abala, Ilili, Munshun, Bas, Lum, Apopanax. These mean nothing to him. Others, Drudge, Asswipe, Black, Red, Chicago, and Ty, are actual words but have no context. Printed up one side of the sheet is Who Put the Ram in the Ramalama Ding Dong. Up the other, like a teletype stuck in repeat mode, is this. Black House Crimson King Black House Crimson King Black. If you waste time looking for sense in this, you're as crazy as she is, Fred thinks. You can't waste time. Time. He looks at the clock on his side of the bed and cannot believe its news. 4:17 p.m. Is that possible? He looks at his watch and sees that it is. Knowing it's foolish, knowing he would have heard his son come in even if in a deep sleep, Fred strides to the door on big, nerveless legs. Ty? He yells. Hey, Ty! Tyler! Waiting for an answer that will not come, Fred realizes that everything in his life has changed, quite possibly forever. People tell you this can happen in the blink of an eye, they say, before you know it, they say. But you don't believe it. Then a wind comes. Go down to Ty's room. Check. Be sure. Ty isn't there. Fred knows this. But he does it just the same. The room is empty as he knew it would be. And it looks oddly distorted, almost sinister, with the dresser now on the other side. Judy, you left her alone, you idiot. She'll be chewing paper again by now. They're clever. Mad people are clever. Fred dashes back down to the master bedroom and exhales a sigh of relief when he sees Judy lying just as he left her, face down, hair spread around her head. He discovers that his worries about his mad wife are now secondary to his worries about his missing son. He'll be home by 4 at the latest, take it to the bank, so he had thought. But 4 has come and gone. A strong wind has arisen and blown the bank away. Fred walks to his side of the bed and sits down beside his wife's splayed right leg. He picks up the phone and punches in a number. It's an easy number, only 3 digits. Hello, Police Department, Officer Duloc speaking. You've dialed 911. Do you have an emergency? Officer Duloc, this is Fred Marshall. I'd like to speak to Dale if he's still there. Fred is pretty sure Dale is. He works late most nights, especially since he pushes the rest away. But inside his head, the wind blows harder, louder. Gee, Mr. Marshall, he's here, but he's in a meeting, and I don't think I can get him. Mr. Marshall, you're not hearing me. He's in with 2 guys from the WSP and 1 from the FBI. If you could just tell me... Fred closes his eyes. It's interesting, isn't it? Something interesting here. He called in on the 911 line, but the idiot on the other end seems to have forgotten that. Why? Because it's someone he knows. It's good old Fred Marshall. Bought a Deere lawn tractor from him just the year before last. Must have dialed 911 because it was easier than looking up the regular number. Because no one Bobby knows can actually have an emergency. Fred remembers having a similar idea himself that morning. A different Fred Marshall. One who believed that the fisherman could never touch his son. Not his son. Ty's gone, Gorg fascinated him, and the Abala took him. Hello? Mr. Marshall? Fred? Are you still... Listen to me, Fred says, his eyes still closed. Down at Goltz's, he would be calling the man on the other end Bobby by now. But Goltz's has never seemed so far away. Goltz's is in the star system Apopanax on planet Abala. Listen to me carefully. Write it down if you have to. My wife has gone mad and my son is missing. Do you understand those things? Wife mad, son missing. Now put me through to the chief. But Bobby Duloc doesn't. Not right away. He has made a deduction. A more diplomatic police officer, Jack Sawyer, as he was in his salad days, for instance, would have kept said deduction to himself. But Bobby can't do that. Bobby has hooked a big one. Mr. Marshall, Fred, your son doesn't own a Schwinn, does he? 3-speed Schwinn, red, got a novelty license plate that reads, Big Mac? Fred cannot answer. For several long and terrible moments, he cannot even draw a breath. Between his ears, the wind blows both louder and harder. Now it's a hurricane. Gorg fascinated him. The Abala took him. At last, just when it seems he will begin to strangle himself, his chest unlocks, and he takes in a huge, tearing breath. Put Chief Gilbertson on! Do it now, you motherfucker! Although he shrieks this at the top of his lungs, the woman lying face down on the coverlet beside him never moves. There is a click. He's on hold. Not for long, but it's long enough for him to see the scratched, bald place on his missing son's bedroom wall, the swelled column of his mad wife's throat, and blood dribbling through the creel in his dream. His back spasms cruelly, and Fred welcomes the pain. It's like getting a telegram from the real world. Then Dale is on the phone. Dale is asking him what's wrong, and Fred Marshall begins to cry. Chapter 7. God may know where Henry Layden found that astounding suit, but we certainly do not. A costume shop? No, it is too elegant to be a costume. This is the real thing, not an imitation. But what sort of real thing is it? The wide lapels sweep down to an inch below the waist, and the twin flaps of the swallowtail reach nearly to the ankles of the billowing pleated trousers, which seem, beneath the snow-field expanse of the double-breasted waistcoat, to ride nearly at the level of the sternum. On Henry's feet, white, high-buttoned spats adorn white patent leather shoes. About his neck, a stiff, high collar turns its pointed peaks over a wide, flowing, white satin bow tie, perfectly knotted. The total effect is of old-fashioned diplomatic finery harmoniously wedded to a zoot suit. The raffishness of the ensemble outweighs its formality, but the dignity of the swallowtail and the waistcoat contribute to the whole a regal quality of a specific kind, the regality often seen in African-American entertainers and musicians. Escorting Henry to the common room while surly Pete Wexler comes along behind, pushing a handcart loaded with boxes of records, Rebecca Vilas dimly remembers having seen Duke Ellington wearing a white cutaway like this in a clip from some old film. Or was it Cab Calloway? She recalls an upraised eyebrow, a glittering smile, a seductive face, an upright figure posed before a band, but little more. If alive, either Mr. Ellington or Mr. Calloway could have informed Rebecca that Henry's outfit, including the high drape pants with a reet pleat, terms not in her vocabulary, had undoubtedly been handmade by one of four specific tailors located in the black neighborhoods of New York, Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, or Los Angeles. Masters of their trade during the 30s and 40s, underground tailors, men now, alas, as dead as their celebrated clients. Henry Layden knows exactly who tailored his outfit, where it came from, and how it fell into his hands. But when it comes to persons such as Rebecca Vilas, Henry imparts no more information than is already likely to be known. In the corridor leading to the common room, the white cutaway appears to shine from within, an impression only increased by Henry's oversized, daddy-cool dark glasses with bamboo frames, in which what may be tiny sapphires wink at the corners of the bows. Is there maybe some shop that sells spiffy clothes of great 1930s band leaders? Does some museum inherit this stuff and auction it off? Rebecca cannot contain her curiosity a moment longer. Mr. Layden, where did you get that beautiful outfit? From the rear, and taking care to sound as though he is muttering to himself, Pete Wexler opines that obtaining an outfit like that probably requires chasing a person of an ethnicity beginning with the letter N for at least a couple of miles. Henry ignores Pete and smiles. It's all a matter of knowing where to look.
Guess you never heard of CDs, Pete says. They're like this big new breakthrough.
Shut up and tote them bales, me bucko, says Miss Vilas. We're almost there.
Rebecca, my dear, if I may, Henry says. Mr. Wexler has every right to grouse. After all, there's no way he could know that I own about 3,000 CDs, is there? And if the man who originally owned these clothes can be called a nigger, I'd be proud to call myself one, too. That would be an incredible honor. I wish I could claim it. Henry has come to a halt, each in a different way shocked by his use of the forbidden word. Pete and Rebecca have also stopped moving. And, Henry says, we owe respect to those who assist us in the performance of our duties. I asked Mr. Wexler to shake out my suit when he hung it up, and he very kindly obliged me.
Yeah, Pete says. Plus, I also hung up your light and put your turntable and speakers and shit right where you want them.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wexler, Henry says. I appreciate your efforts in my behalf.
Well, shit, Pete says. I was only doing my job, you know. About anything you want after you're done, I'll give you a hand.
Without benefit of a flash of panties or a glimpse of ass, Pete Wexler has been completely disarmed. Rebecca finds this amazing. All in all, sightless or not, Henry Layden, it comes to her, is far and away the coolest human being she has ever been privileged to encounter in her entire 26 years on the face of the earth. Never mind his clothes. Where did guys like this come from?
Do you really think some little boy vanished from the sidewalk out in front of here this afternoon? Henry asks.
What? Rebecca asks.
Seems like it to me. Pete says.
What? Rebecca asks again, this time to Pete Wexler, not Henry. What are you saying?
Well, he asked me and I told him, Pete says. That's all.
Simmering dangerously, Rebecca takes a stride toward him. This happened on our sidewalk. Another kid in front of our building? And you didn't say anything to me or Mr. Maxton?
There wasn't nothing to say, Pete offers in self-defense.
Maybe you could tell us what actually happened, Henry says.
Sure. What happened was I went outside for a smoke, see?
This is less than strictly truthful. Faced with the choice of walking 10 yards to the Daisy Carter men's room to flush his cigarette down a toilet, or walking 10 feet to the entrance and pitching it into the parking lot, Pete had sensibly elected outdoor disposal.
So I get outside, and that's when I saw it. This police car parked right out there. So I walked up to the hedge, and there's this cop, a young guy, I think his name is Cheetah or something like that, and he's loading this bike, like a kid's bike, into his trunk. And something else, too, only I couldn't see what it was, except it was small. And after he did that, he got a piece of chalk out of his glove compartment, and he came back and made, like, X marks on the sidewalk.
Did you talk to him? Rebecca asks. Did you ask him what he was doing?
Miss Vilas, I don't talk to cops unless it's like you got no other choice, know what I mean? Cheetah, he never even saw me. The guy wouldn't have said nothing anyhow. He had this expression on his face. It was like, geez, I hope I get to the crapper before I drop a load in my pants, that kind of expression.
Then he just drove away.
Just like that. 20 minutes later, 2 other cops showed up.
Rebecca raises both hands, closes her eyes, and presses her fingertips to her forehead, giving Pete Wexler an excellent opportunity, of which he does not fail to take full advantage, to admire the shape of her breasts underneath her blouse. It may not be as great as the view from the bottom of the ladder, but it'll do, all right. Yes, it will. As far as Abby's dad is concerned, a sight like Rebecca Vilas's Hottentots pushing out against her blouse is like a good fire on a cold night. They're bigger than you'd expect on a slender little thing like her, and you know what? When the arms go up, the Hottentots go up, too.
Hey, if he had known she was going to put on a show like this, he would have told her about Cheetah and the bicycle as soon as it happened.
All right. Okay, she says, still flattening the tips of her fingers against her head.
She lifts her chin, raising her arms another few inches, and frowns in concentration, for a moment looking like a figure on a plinth.
Hooray and hallelujah, Pete thinks. There's a bright side to everything. If another little snot-nose gets grabbed off the sidewalk tomorrow morning, it won't be soon enough for me.
Rebecca says, "Okay, okay, okay," opens her eyes and lowers her arms. Pete Wexler is staring firmly at a point over her shoulder, his face blank with a false innocence she immediately comprehends. Good God, what a caveman. It's not as bad as I thought. In the first place, all you saw was a policeman picking up a bike. Maybe it was stolen. Maybe some other kid borrowed the bike, dumped it, and ran away. The cop could have been looking for it. Or the kid who owned the bike could have been hit by a car or something. And even if the worst did happen, I don't see any way that it could hurt us. Maxton's isn't responsible for whatever goes on outside the grounds. She turns to Henry, who looks as though he wishes he were 100 miles away.
Sorry. I know that sounded awfully cold. I'm as distressed about this fisherman business as everyone else. What with those two poor kids and the missing girl. We're all so upset we can hardly think straight. But I'd hate to see us dragged into the mess, don't you see?
I see perfectly, Henry says. Being one of those blind men George Rathbun is always yelling about.
Ha! Pete Wexler barks. And you agree with me, don't you?
I'm a gentleman. I agree with everybody, Henry says. I agree with Pete that another child may well have been abducted by our local monster. Officer Cheetah, or whatever his name is, sounded too anxious to be just picking up a lost bicycle. And I agree with you that Maxton's cannot be blamed for anything that happened.
Good, Rebecca says.
Unless, of course, someone here is involved in the murders of these children.
But that's impossible, Rebecca says. Most of our male clients can't even remember their own names.
A 10-year-old girl could take most of these feebs, Pete says. Even the ones who don't have old-timers disease walk around covered in their own, you know.
You're forgetting about the staff, Henry says.
Oh, now,
Rebecca says, momentarily rendered nearly wordless.
Come on, that's a totally irresponsible thing to say.
True, it is. But if this goes on, nobody will be above suspicion. That's my point. Pete Wexler feels a sudden chill. If the town clowns start grilling Maxton's residence, his private amusements might come to light. And wouldn't Wendell Green have a field day with that stuff? A gleaming new idea comes to him, and he brings it forth, hoping to impress Miss Vilas.
You know what? The cops should talk to that California guy, the big-time detective who nailed that Kinderling asshole 2-3 years ago. He lives around here somewhere, don't he? Someone like that, he's the guy we need on this. The cops here, they're way out of their depth. That guy, he's like a, what do you call it, a goddamn resource.
Odd you should say that, Henry says. I couldn't agree with you more. It is about time Jack Sawyer did his thing. I'll work on him again.
You know him?
Rebecca asks.
Oh, yes, Henry says. That I do.
But isn't it about time for me to do my own thing?
Soon, they're all still outside.
Rebecca leads him down the rest of the corridor and into the common room, where all three of them move across to the big platform. Henry's microphone stands beside a table mounted with his speakers and turntable. With unnerving accuracy, Henry says, "A lot of space in here."
You can tell that? She asks.
Piece of cake. Henry says. We must be getting close now.
It's right in front of you. Do you need any help?
Henry extends one foot and taps the side of the flat. He glides a hand down the edge of the table, locates the mic stand, says, "Not at the moment, darling," and steps neatly up onto the platform. Guided by touch, he moves to the back of the table and locates the turntable. "All is copacetic," he says. "Pete, would you please put the record boxes on the table? The one on top goes here, and the other one right next to it."
"What's he like, your friend Jack?" Rebecca asks.
"An orphan of the storm. A pussycat. But an extremely difficult pussycat.
I have to say he can be a real pain in the bunghole.
Crowd noises, a buzz of conversation interlaced with children's voices, and songs thumped out on an old upright piano have been audible through the window since they entered the room. And when Pete has placed the record boxes on the table, he says,
I better get out there, because Chipper's probably looking for me. Gonna be a shitload of cleanup once they come inside.
Pete shambles out, rolling the handcart before him. Rebecca asks if there is anything more Henry would like her to do for him. The overhead lights are on, aren't they? Please turn them off and wait for the first wave to come in. Then switch on the pink spot and prepare to jitterbug your heart out.
You want me to turn off the lights?
You'll see. Rebecca moves back across to the door, turns off the overhead lights, and does see, just as Henry had promised. A soft, dim illumination from the rank of windows hovers in the air, replacing the former brightness and harshness with a vague, mellow haze, as if the room lay behind a scrim. That pink spotlight is going to look pretty good in here, Rebecca thinks. Outside, on the lawn, the pre-dance party wingding is winding down. Lots of old men and women are busily polishing off their strawberry shortcakes and soda pop at the picnic tables, and the piano-playing gent in the straw boater and red sleeve garters comes to the end of Heart and Soul, ba-bump, ba-bump, ba-ba-bump, bump, bump, no finesse, but plenty of volume, closes the lid of the upright, and stands up to a scattering of applause. Grandchildren who had earlier complained about having to come to the great fest dodge through the tables and wheelchairs, evading their parents' glances and hoping to wheedle a last balloon from the balloon lady in the clown suit and frizzy red wig. Oh, joy unbounded. Alice Weathers applauds the piano player, as well she might. 40 years ago, he reluctantly absorbed the rudiments of pianism at her hands, just well enough to pick up a few bucks at occasions like this, when not obliged to perform his usual function, that of selling sweatshirts and baseball caps on Chase Street. Charles Burnside, who, having been scrubbed clean by good-hearted Butch Yerxa, decked himself out in an old white shirt and a pair of loose, filthy trousers, stands slightly apart from the throng in the shade of a large oak, not applauding but sneering. The unbuttoned collar of the shirt droops around his ropey neck. Now and then he wipes his mouth or picks his teeth with a ragged thumbnail, but mainly he does not move at all. He looks as though someone plunked him down by the side of a road and drove off. Whenever the careering grandkids swerve near Bernie, they instantly veer away as if repelled by a force field. Between Alice and Bernie, three-fourths of the residents of Maxton's belly up to the tables, stump around on their walkers, sit beneath the trees, occupy their wheelchairs, hobble here and there, yakking, dozing, chuckling, farting, dabbing at fresh strawberry-colored stains on their clothing, staring at their relatives, staring at their trembling hands, staring at nothing. Half a dozen of the most vacant among them wear conical party hats of hard flat red and hard flat blue, the shades of enforced gaiety. The women from the kitchen have begun to circulate through the tables with big black garbage bags, for soon they must retire to their domain to prepare the evening's great feast of potato salad, mashed potatoes, creamed potatoes, baked beans, jello salad, marshmallow salad, and whipped cream salad. Plus, of course, the mighty strawberry shortcake. The undisputed and hereditary sovereign of this realm, Chipper Maxton, whose disposition generally resembles that of a skunk trapped in a muddy hole, has spent the previous 90 minutes ambling about, smiling and shaking hands, and he has had enough.
Pete, he growls, what the hell took you so long? Start racking up the folding chairs, okay? And help shift these people into the common room. Let's get a goddamn move on here. Wagons west.
Pete scurries off, and Chipper claps his hands twice loudly, then raises his outstretched arms.
Hey, everybody, he bellows. Can you truly believe what a gall-durn gorgeous day the good Lord gave us for this beautiful event? Isn't this something?
Half a dozen feeble voices rise in agreement.
Come on, people, you can do better than that. I want to hear it for this wonderful day, this wonderful time we're all having, and for all the wonderful help and assistance given us by our volunteers and staff.
A slightly more exuberant clamor rewards his efforts.
All right! Hey, you know what? As George Rathbun would say, even a blind man could see what a great time